Hour is for guidance only. You should always seek your own independent legal opinion. I'll be back next Sunday, 9 p.m. with another LBC Consumer Hour. In the meantime, if you missed any of tonight's show, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app, where you can stay up to date with all the latest news and opinion, put your news categories in the order you want, pause and rewind live radio, and listen to a range of podcasts. Download the all-new official LBC app for free from your app store now. Coming up at 1, it's Richard Spur, but next here on LBC, it's Nick Abbott.
Thank you, Dean. A packed programme tonight. We will hear about a breakthrough that could lead to the creation of artificial life. We'll talk to a council leader in Minneapolis on the latest from the city under attack from the Trump regime. We'll hear from a homelessness charity about the crisis gripping school children in this country. We'll talk about the difficulties of working the night shift and hear about the new British version of the FBI. But first, what next for Andy Burnham and the Labour Party? All that and more with me, Nick Abbott, after the new news at 10 on LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, Andy Burnham says he's disappointed by the decision to block him from standing in the Gorton and Denton by-election. 8 members of Labour's ruling body, including the Prime Minister, voted against giving the Mayor of Greater Manchester permission. The decision is partly being justified by the cost of holding another mayoral election to replace him. But LBC's political correspondent Aggie Chambray says it hasn't pleased some.
We are already starting to see that filter through, and I've got some extraordinary text messages on my phone. We've heard from people like former Cabinet Minister Louise Hague, who said the decision was incredibly disappointing. She called for the NEC, that's the National Executive Committee, to change course and make the right decision.
And there'll be more on this with Nick Abbott here on LBC over the next hour. The governor of Minnesota has accused the Trump administration of gaslighting American citizens over the fatal shooting of a man in Minneapolis. 37-year-old Alex Pretty was an intensive care nurse. He was shot several times by immigration agents on Saturday. His family is disputing their claims he was armed and wanted to massacre law enforcement. Governor Tim Walz has lashed out at the U.S. government.
You heard the most powerful people in the world narrate to you what you were looking at, sullying his name, and then closing the crime scene, sweeping away the evidence, defying a court order, and not allowing anyone to look at it.
Police investigating a woman's death on Tyneside have arrested a teenager on the suspicion of murder. She was in her 40s and was found with injuries in North Shields on Saturday night. A woman in her 50s has also been detained. And more than 1 million addresses in the US have been left without power as a winter storm continues making its way through southern and eastern states. More than 10,000 flights have also been cancelled during today. President Trump has described the weather system as historic. The forecaster Jim Dale's been telling LBC it's bringing multiple hazards.
It isn't just about snow. It isn't just about freezing rain. There's also high winds involved. There's been tornadoes down in Georgia. And what's caused it? Well, in the first instance, dislocation of the polar vortex. That means that polar air streaming south through Canada, very frigid Canada, then meeting warm, mild air.
LBC weather for the UK, mostly dry across England and Wales overnight. Light rain, which could turn wintry over higher ground for northeastern Scotland. We'll see a low of around 2 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Good evening. So, as you probably know, Labour's National Executive Committee has blocked Andy Burnham's request to seek selection for the Gorton and Denton by-elections, setting off quite the row. Let's talk about this with Barry Gardiner. Barry is Labour MP for Brent West and was a minister under Tony Blair, and he joins us on the line now. Good evening, Barry.
Good evening, Nick. Hi, here.
Am I right in thinking that the party rules about sitting mayors completing their term of office are clear? And if that's true, was Andy Burnham ignorant of the rules? Was he naive that they would be set aside in his case? Or did he go ahead knowing that he'd be rejected in order to play the martyr?
No, not at all. I think the rules are that if you want to step down from that role, then you have to seek the approval of the NEC. And that's what Andy did. He didn't do anything other than in accordance with the rules, as I understand it.
Yeah, but do you think that he was expecting the answer that he got?
No, I don't think so. Look, I'm sure the NEC has persuaded itself they voted to stop Andy for the best possible reasons. They've said that it was about the costs of a potential election for the mayor to replace him. They said they didn't want to interrupt all the good work he was doing in Manchester. They didn't want to destabilise the party, they said, with some sort of psychodrama in Parliament. But actually, I think they know, and we all know, that they're deluding themselves. This was about keeping power to themselves. It was about control. It was about quashing any view other than number 10s and stopping anyone who might become a focus of dissent.
Yeah, I mean, there is a point, though, about the costs, though, isn't there? I mean, if he did quit as mayor, it might hurt the Labour Party dearly, not just financially. I mean, there would be the expense of a new mayor's election campaign and fighting for the Gorton and Denton seat. They might lose both.
Well, look, that's absolutely true. But in politics, you know, any election is a risk. You can't guarantee what the electorate are going to do beforehand. But I think, you know, had they not panicked and blocked him, this could actually have helped Keir Starmer. It would have shown a prime minister at ease with himself, with his party, unafraid of a challenge, because he was confident that our policies were beginning to cut through. As it is, it smells of fear, and, you know, the one thing the electorate always are pretty sure to detect is when a politician is running scared, and I think they may well punish him for it.
In what way?
Well, at the ballot box, both in the by-election and in the May elections, you know, people like to feel that the Prime Minister actually is confident in their policies, that they're going forward, that they're going to work, not to fear that they're actually in an insecure position. I'm confident we can still win the by-election in Denton, but I think Andy would have been a great candidate if he had been selected by the local party. Now there will be a list put together of those candidates who will eventually be selected. And, you know, I look forward to finding out who our candidate will be. And obviously I will support them and am confident that they can win that by-election.
Yeah, and that by-election is in Andy Burnham's manor, so to speak. And if he is not on the list and somebody else might have less of a chance to beat either the Greens or Reform, then do you think that the NEC might think again?
No, I don't think they're going to think it again at all. I thought it was very good that Andy today came out straight away and said, look, he will be there supporting whoever is the candidate in that by-election supporting them to win it. And that's absolutely right. He said exactly what he should say. And I'm sure he'll you know, abide by that. We all want the Labour Party to do well, whichever, you know, side of the party people say they're on. Everybody in the Labour Party should want us to win that by-election to stop the threat of any other party getting another seat in Parliament. But I do think that democracy in the party would have allowed the widest possible choice for the local constituency to make, and Andy should have been part of that.
It seems like another communications fail, doesn't it? The top tier seem to have a particular difficulty in putting across any sort of positive message about themselves or what they are doing. The comms has been terrible.
Well, look, I think you're right. And that's why I said that they shouldn't have panicked. They shouldn't have blocked him in this way, because to do that is almost to show weakness. So if you're trying to assert your authority and think that's going to make you look strong in a situation like this, I think it doesn't. I think it actually makes you look weak. And that's not a good communication strategy for any prime minister. So I think tactically it's been a mistake. But look, I look forward to campaigning for a successful Labour outcome in that by-election.
Is it possible that the National Executive Committee have actually done Andy Burnham a favour? I mean, he could have quit his high-profile job, he's got a six-figure salary, he's very sort of out there as the face of Manchester, one of our greatest cities.
Yeah.
He could have put his all on winning Gorton and Denton and lost, and that would rather have taken the sparkle off him.
Look, of course that's right, but Andy, in the letter that he sent to the NEC, and I read it very carefully, he put himself forward, I think, genuinely because he believed that he was the best candidate to win that seat for Labour to ensure that Labour came through that by-election strong. It's a midterm by-election where the polls are not in our favour at the moment. But I think he felt, and many people felt, that if he had been the candidate, if he had been selected, then we would have stood a much better chance, and I think a very good chance, of winning that by-election. So I think he put himself forward in the right way. The NEC have rejected that, but the NEC will then have to live with the repercussions of that. And my fear is that because this is looked like a decision taken out of trying to protect number 10, it's been taken out of weakness. And I think actually it will light the blue touch paper for an eventual challenge in due course, not from Andy Burnham, but perhaps from somebody else within the party.
Yes. So what's the mood then on the backbenches?
Well, look, I think it's very mixed. I mean, thank goodness the Labour Party, both in the country and in Parliament, is a pretty broad church still. Not as broad, I think, as I might like it, but it's still a pretty broad church. And in Parliament, there are different views. Some people say, no, don't rock the boat, keep things tight, make sure that the Prime Minister gets exactly what he wants at all times. Others say, look, maybe we need to listen more, and the polls are reflecting the fact that actually there has not been enough consultation across the party, there's not been enough listening, and if you look at the number of U-turns that this government has had to make, that really speaks for itself, that actually had they taken notice of some of the people actually who were suspended from the party for voting against a policy, only to find a few months or sometimes even weeks later, the party then did a U-turn and adopted their position. That, to me, means that actually the leadership need to take note, the NEC needs to take note, that listening to the backbenchers is actually not a bad idea.
Yes, but I wonder if that sort of sits with the public well, because, there's an air of the public wanting somebody strong and decisive and someone who takes charge, like a Trump person or a Farage type of person, and listening to the backbenchers and taking the temperature of the room and all that. It sounds a bit wishy-washy. Is that actually what the public are after?
No, what they want is good policies. The public want a government that's not doing a U-turn every 6 months or every 6 weeks, indeed. The public want a government that says, okay, we've consulted properly, we've made our decision, this is what we're going to do, and then sticks with it and doesn't actually then have to grow back because they didn't actually take into account all the factors that if they'd spoken to people, they'd have realised were there.
Does all this look a bit like the chaotic infighting that helped turn the public off the Tory party during their tenure in number 10?
Well, look, come on, Nick. The Tories had, what was it, five prime ministers, in 10 years. Not even that, five prime ministers in, what was it, 6 years or something. I mean, that was chaos. It was a very, very crazy time in politics. And, you know, I'm glad that we are trying to get stability back into our politics. But stability does not mean dictatorial control. Stability is actually about making sure that you have a set of policies that everyone in your party is signed up to and can go forward with. There will always be disagreements, but actually consensus is not a bad thing, and dictatorship is. And you mentioned Trump. Well, boy, you see what chaos there is because of Trump.
Well, yes, but the Trump-aligned party, Reform, are doing particularly well.
Yes, I think at the moment the public were fed up with the Conservatives. There's no question about that. They voted hugely against them in the last election. But actually, you know, they're pretty fed up with us at the moment as well. And therefore, an other party, and let's face it, we've had UKIP, the Independence Party, we've had the Brexit Party, we've had the, you know, Mr. Farage has offered himself in many forms to the electorate, and they are an alternative to two mainstream parties, which people are saying at the moment we're pretty fed up with both of you. It's midterm. What we have to do is to create the stability in the Labour Party, but more so in the government, so that we can actually begin to get to the point where people say, you know what, actually, yeah, they have brought waiting lists down by 5 million appointments. They, you know, they have actually changed the situation for me in terms of childcare. They are actually beginning to get to grips with some of the issues that were such a problem under the Conservatives. And, you know, goodness me, we're even seeing, you know, 2,500 more doctors, GP doctors recruited, and that's going to eventually translate into me being able to get an appointment at my GP surgery. So, look, government is not a quick fix process. We've had 14 years of Conservative policies where incomes did not rise. I mean, the people, when we came in 2024, were actually earning less in real terms than they had been when we left office in 2010. It takes time.
Absolutely.
It takes time to do that. Yes. And we are doing it.
Yes. Every now and again, I read out a list of what could be described as the achievements under the Labour government so far under Keir Starmer. And it's a list that no one has ever heard. That's the problem, isn't it? Yeah. It doesn't matter what the Labour Party does. It's getting it across to the public. And the method that the public get of receiving their information are never going to print anything positive about the Labour Party.
Yeah. Yeah, Nick, look, you're speaking to the choir here. I absolutely agree with you. And I've spoken to people around Keir. I've spoken to colleagues in Parliament, as well as the sort of the faceless ones behind, and said precisely this. They need to understand that it's about getting out there, not dismissing people, and I think particularly for those who are perhaps prone to think, well, maybe I should give Reform a try, instead of saying, oh, these people are racists and we don't need to talk to them and they're this and they're that, right-wing fascists and so on. No, what you've got to do is you've got to say, okay, we understand what your concerns are. Here's why we think that what you're being offered from Reform is just snake oil. It's never going to work, and these are the reasons why. And this is what we're doing to actually address the legitimate concerns that you have.
And do you think that one a shining example of doing just that, of sort of going around the billionaire offshore owned press, is currently being demonstrated by the Green Party, whose fortunes have been transformed by the very savvy PR campaign of their new leader? What do you make of that?
Well, I know the person who is behind the PR campaign of the Greens, and they used to be doing the same for the Labour Party back in 2017. But I would say this to you. The PR is great, and all politicians love being the, you know, the center of the moment and feeling that they've got, you know, great social media profile and all the rest of it and making a stir. But actually it's very different from, having real policies for government and, being able to show people that you can take the country in a different direction. Mm. And, you know, I think if you look at the new leadership and on the Green Party, I've got great respect for some of the Green MPs in Parliament. I think, in fact, Ellie Chowns, who was, I think the alternative candidate for the leadership of the Green Party, is an eminently sensible, eminently pragmatic woman with huge principles. And, you know, I worked alongside her in select committee. I think she's excellent. But I think some of the other people in their party are completely bonkers.
One final question. You often only get one chance at the top job in politics. Do you think that this was Andy Burnham's?
Look, I don't rule anybody out in politics. Who would ever have said that Jeremy Corbyn, after 40 years in Parliament, was going to become leader of the party? You know, so politics is a very strange thing. But what I would say is that my view is that there is now a new generation in Parliament, and Andy is a very senior, very, very important Labour figure in the country and in the party. He now, in effect, will have to wait, if he wants to come back into Parliament, until the next general election, which will be possibly 2029. And at that stage, he will have been out of Parliament for a very long time, since, what, 2015, 2016. So he'll have been out of Parliament, I think, longer than he was in it. I think, you know, each generation comes along, they throw up really important figures in the Labour movement, and I think this new generation will do the same. And I think it may be too late for Andy, but that does not mean that Andy Burnham does not have a huge future in the Labour Party, because he's an incredibly experienced politician. He was a superb minister, and he has been an absolutely brilliant mayor of Greater Manchester. And I'm sure that his voice in the party will always carry enormous weight, whatever role he chooses to play.
Very good to talk to you, Barry. Thanks so much for that. Barry Gardiner, Labour MP for Brent West. What are your thoughts on what's happened? 0345 6060 973.
LBC.
At Lidl, get great deals on award-winning fruit and veg with Pick of the Week. Save up to 35% with cauliflower, now just 99p each. And with Lidl Plus, get red grapefruit for only 29p. In store now. Lidl, more to value. Limited offer subject to availability. Selected stores, GB only. Prices correct on 20th of the 1st. 18 plus terms apply. See lidl.co.uk/lptv.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running. Octopus Energy.
Hannah entered the Omaze Million Pound House draw and won a £4 million house.
House, an actual house!
Paul won a house too.
That's insane.
Now you could be next when you enter by midnight tonight at omaze.co.uk. Because one person is guaranteed to win a £5 million house in London with all the furniture. And £250,000 just to help you settle in. Roger recently opened the door to a brand new future.
It is a dream.
And this time, it could be you.
And here's the best part. You'll be supporting Alzheimer's Society.
So for your chance to win a luxury house in London worth £5 million, you must enter by midnight tonight at omaze.co.uk. Over 18s only, no purchase necessary, conditions apply. £1 million charity donation.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So Andy Burnham is to spend his time on improving the lives of the good people of Manchester and not going forward as a prospective MP. He has been refused the right to do that by the National Executive Committee. They have blocked Andy Burnham's request to seek selection for the Gorton and Denton by-election. This is setting off something of the row, as you've heard. 0345 6060 973. There's lots to talk about on this subject. I mean, what do you think that this has done to Keir Starmer's position, for instance? Bootle. Hello, Sarah.
Hello, Nick.
Sarah.
Well, let's just put it this way. Starmer and his political strumpets, and before anybody starts saying, clutching at their pearls and twin sets, going, how dare you say that, a political strumpet is somebody who who's in politics, who slavishly obeys the leader instead of using their brain and going, hey, hang on a minute, you're wrong there, as some of our parliamentarians have done and have been suspended.
Well, wrong in what way? Why are they wrong?
I'll tell you why. Because by doing what he's done, by getting his cronies on the NEC to vote against having Andy Burnham go forward as a candidate, he has just proven what a bullying little coward he is. Who does he think he is, an embryonic Trump? Because this is how he's behaving. And this is how he has behaved all the way through. Anybody who disagrees with him on policy, be it Ian Burnham from West Derby or...
Sarah, we have lost you, I'm afraid. That is the beauty of the mobile phone. It's not really ready to be used as a phone. But I understand that you are irate. Thank you, Sarah. Better luck next time. 0345 6060 973. Phil says, you have to head back to the 1860s and William Gladstone's reign since the last time a UK Prime Minister hailed from the northwest of the UK. A big mistake on the part of Labour not to add Andy Burnham to their ranks and the history books. Well, I mean, what about the people of Greater Manchester who elected Andy Burnham in the expectation that he would fulfil his role? And then quitting halfway through seems a bit self-interested, is it not? If you've got a job and you have a contract with the people, surely you finish that job and then decide what you might want to do. Richmond, hello, Aisling.
Hi, Nick. Hiya. I might actually start on that point, on that last point you just made, rather than starting where I was going to. I suppose the people of Manchester, in terms of if Andy Burnham gave up the mayorship now, I think, would people not prefer that the country was in a better state overall and that... basically what I was going to say was I think it was a bad decision to block him. I think it was a bad decision. It was a silly decision and it was also really unfair. I don't think you can justify it by saying it would cost too much to run the two elections. I don't think that's justification because it's almost anti-democratic, because if he wants to run, why block him? It just doesn't seem fair. It just doesn't seem fair. And if they end up losing that seat to reform, that's really going to be the end of Keir Starmer's not going to have much to stand on after
but what,
that.
What
it's
is,
disappointing.
Yeah, but what is entirely possible is that Andy Burnham would have resigned his position as mayor to fight this seat. He would have lost the seat to reform, perhaps. And also, they would have lost the mayoralty of Manchester to perhaps reform as well. And that would have lost it. Well, I've got no idea.
I think there was general standing saying that he probably would have won that seat. He was probably the best candidate to win it compared to who else might stand. I mean, don't know who else might stand for Labour in that seat, but I think that Andy Burnham would have had a better chance of winning it, and that may be part of the reason he may have won it was because people might have wanted to see him in Westminster.
Do you think that Andy Burnham could have predicted all this, and in fact probably did predict all of this? I mean, it was always thought unlikely that he was going to be accepted in his role to leave the current role and to take on another one. I mean, do you think he was just hopeful, naive, or he had an idea that this is exactly what would happen?
Maybe, but I suppose we couldn't have predicted a by-election would definitely occur because, you know, the candidate, the MP that had to stand down because of his health, that might not have been predictable. But I just think that whatever the case, I think it was unfair to block him because that just does it also just looks really bad on Labour and the NEC. It just doesn't wash well, I think, overall. And it just, you can't just justify it by saying it would cost too much to, it'd be really, really disappointing if they end up losing, I mean, now they could end up losing both the mayorship and the seat, and that would just be a right mess. But
yes.
We'll see.
But at least in the medium term, they can only lose the seats. They can't lose the mayorship.
True, true.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Good talking to you, Ashley. Thanks a lot. 0345 6060 973. Ash in Harrow says the NEC made the correct decision on Burnham. He should not be fast-tracked. He needs to complete his mayoral terms. Be patient, Andy. Your time will come. Labour is doing a fantastic job currently. The cost is high, is too high for Labour now. I don't quite understand the last part of that, but the first part made sense. Thanks for that. More of your thoughts on this to come. And the government has promised a British police equivalent to the FBI. Will it work? We'll have more details on that after the news headlines with Tim Daly.
Andy Burnham says he's disappointed by a decision to block him from standing in the Gorton and Denton by-election. Eight members of Labour's ruling body, including the Prime Minister, voted against giving the Mayor of Greater Manchester permission. The Home Secretary is to set out new plans to change the way England and Wales is policed. Shabana Mahmood's due to announce a range of measures tomorrow, which the government now says will include measures to get more officers onto the streets and away from admin work. And the Governor of Minnesota has accused the Trump administration of gaslighting American citizens over the fatal shooting of a man in Minneapolis. 37-year-old Alex Pretty was an intensive care nurse. He was shot several times by immigration agents on Saturday. LBC weather, mostly dry across England and Wales overnight. Light rain, which could turn to snow over higher ground in northeastern Scotland. And we'll see a low of around 2 degrees.
This is LBC.
Quick question. Well, actually three. But they are quick. One, do you have a car? Two, are you looking to save on your car insurance? And three, do you have a Tesco club card? Well, if you do, you could get exclusive club card prices when you take out or renew a policy with Tesco Car Insurance. And with three levels of cover available, you can choose the one that's right for you. Over a million club card members are already saving money. So just search online for Tesco Car Insurance.
The people at Britain love their spin bikes. They also love moving their card balances to a Barclaycard Platinum Balance Transfer Card with no interest for 36 months and £20 cash back until the 29th of January 2026.
A balance transfer fee of 3.45% applies, subject to financial status. T's and C's and exclusions apply. Check if you're eligible at barclaycard.co.uk. Representative example, 24.9% APR representative variable and 24.9% purchase rate per annum based on a £1,200 credit limit.
Things are really heating up in the country's smallest house.
Dad!
Squealed Mia Mouse.
We could save around £100 by setting the boiler flow temperature to 60 degrees.
And turning radiators down in rooms we don't use.
Interrupted Mo.
Yes, Mo.
Turn them down.
Not off,
said Mia.
Plus finding and blocking drafts,
said Mo.
Should save enough to increase our allowance.
A little saves a lot. You could save around £100 a year off your energy bills with three tips at gov.uk/cleanenergy.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
More of your calls and thoughts about the future of Andy Burnham and how it has, this episode has reflected on the Labour Party in general and Keir Starmer in particular. That's to come. But first, let's talk about the Home Secretary announcing on Monday a new National Police Service, which is, in effect, Britain's FBI. And as part of that, the post of a National Public Order Commander will be created. Let's talk about this with Dal Babu. Dal is a former Chief Superintendent in the Metropolitan Police and joins us on the line now. Hello, Dal.
Good evening, Nick.
What problem does this solve?
Well, policing has not been reviewed in a significant way since the 1960s. And since then, we've had the introduction of the internet, which has led to a real level of criminality on the internet. Many of us will know at least somebody who has been fleeced on the internet. And so a lot of crime now takes place on the internet. But we also have a situation where we have 43 forces. The largest, the Metropolitan Police, accounts for almost 30% of the entire policing in England and Wales. The other 42 account for the remaining 70%. So there's a real opportunity to try and even out policing, and also just to have a much more coordinated way of looking at how you can share information. The bizarre thing at the moment is you have 43 forces, although some of them do some work together, who will be buying uniform separately. They'll be hiring and buying cars separately. They'll be buying IT equipment separately. So there's a real opportunity in terms of economies of scale of bringing those smaller forces together. And some of the smaller forces, like, for example, Gwent, Warwickshire, even though they've got significant infrastructure in the senior management, chief constables, deputy chief constables, assistant chief constables, they are no lot bigger than basic command units in some of the bigger metropolitan forces. In fact, many of them are smaller than them.
Right. So this new National Police Service is being announced on Monday. Presumably it will be the same people who are currently under employment in the police service. So what are the police forces that are going to be drained of those people going to then have to do in order to make up the numbers?
I think this will be still from the same envelope, as I understand, but the devil will be in the detail. But ultimately, we police officers spend a lot of time, for example, if somebody commits an online theft or fraud in Greater Manchester, and the perpetrator is in Southampton in Hampshire, they'd still have to do that coordination and that work. I think this would be looking at how you could make that much more efficient. There may be some opportunities for some of the issues around terrorism to be undertaken by this group and have a better understanding of the terrorist picture across the country. So there's a whole range of things. So although you're dealing with the same envelope, I think it's about increasing that efficiency at the moment.
Right, so there's two sides to this. One is this new National Police Service, which is being described as Britain's FBI, and the other is this post of a National Public Order Commander. In an era when the right to protest is seemingly under attack in this country with, you know, mass arrests of climate change and Palestine protesters, do you think there's something a little sinister about the establishment of a National Public Order Commander?
Not necessarily. I mean, there's lots of mutual aid that goes on already. So, for example, when the forces have a major demonstration or a major event, they will often call on other forces to help and assist. It's called mutual aid. So so you end up with, particularly with some of the smaller forces, they would be unable to cope with the amount of police officers you need to coordinate a large march and demonstration. So I don't think we should see this as being anything sinister. It's really about better use and more coordinated resources. At the moment, as and when is required, there's a request for mutual aid from other forces. But this would be about making sure these resources are used efficiently and effectively.
And yet the language used by the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, is eerily reminiscent of the Trump regime. She talks of cracking down to keep us safe. Shouldn't we be concerned about that?
You know, ultimately, this will be police officers who are not involved in politics who will be making decisions. I think, you know, politicians will use language. They'll make comments, but ultimately, this will be the police officers who will be without fear or favour will be making sure that they've got a consistent approach across the country in terms of managing demonstrations.
And so, sorry to interrupt, but as far as you're aware, then this public order commander and the National Police Service chief will report not to the government directly, then, as is the case at the moment. They will set their own operational parameters. Is that right?
They'll have independence operational, but ultimately, I think one of the things the Home Secretary is looking to do, following the challenges there were with the West Midlands chief constable, who she wanted to get rid of, and didn't have the power. It was the Police and Crime Commissioner. So there will be some changes, and part of the, my understanding is part of it is the Police and Crime Commissioners, each force has a police and crime commissioner. They will be the role will be taken away, so there'll be a local committee that'll be responsible. I think if I was to ask you or your listeners, who is your police and crime commissioner? I think people would be very, very hard pushed to identify who that person is. Mm. Just as they would be probably hard pushed to identify who the chief constable is for that area. Yeah. So I think the idea that we rationalise 43 forces into 12, which is one of the numbers that have been suggested. And I think what we need to make sure in any changes, that we still continue to have neighbourhood policing, local officers are known to their local communities. But I don't think that necessarily will mean that it doesn't happen with a new system, because if you look at the something like the larger forces that have thousands of officers, you still have the same kind of neighbourhood model as you do with those forces with smaller officers.
Yes, but that is sort of the opposite of this National Public Order Commander, who will apparently only be used if disorder spreads past the local, which might not happen frequently, if ever. What will they do all day?
Well, I think, you know, at the moment you have a national a service that basically, although it's not an official one, you still have police officers who basically are responsible for coordinating mutual aid. So I think this will be about coordinating greater efficiency, and hopefully it will mean that there's less likelihood of officers being taken away from their neighbourhoods, and you'll have a specialist group of officers who will be coordinated and can work in a more coordinated way. So I mean, I don't really see any disadvantages of this system. I think operational police officers have been calling for a greater rationale for some time, and I think there's a real opportunity now to have a much more effective, much more efficient police service. So, for example, the police and crime, doing away with the police and crime commissioners is going to save £100 million. According to the Home Secretary, I think the opportunity to buy uniforms in with economies of scale and vehicles and IT equipment, there's huge savings that are potentially going to happen there. So I think this will be about the more efficient police service on top of the changes, where you'll have a more coordinated way of using resources.
And how is all these changes going down among the ranks?
I think people will be looking for the devil will be in the detail, but you've certainly seen the higher echelons of the police service are very much in favour of these changes. They've been talking about these changes. Many of these ideas are not new. There's a national crime agency already, which sort of is will probably be taken over by the national police service already. So we already have some national functions, and some forces have responsibility for a national area. So, for example, Metropolitan Police has responsibility for counterterrorism. You have other forces, Wexhurst, who have responsibility for. So, there's a whole range of other forces who already have national responsibility. So, this will be about making it much more coordinated in a structured way. And this won't happen overnight. This will require consultation, working with local communities, working with staff associations, police federation, superintendents association, to make sure that the service doesn't disadvantage people. So, you know, all the concerns that people have, there'll be an opportunity to feed into it, for organisations to be consulted and make sure that people have genuine confidence in the new system that's been proposed.
Very good to talk to you, Dal. Thanks so much for that. Dal Babu, former chief superintendent in the Metropolitan Police. Right, let's go back to what we were talking about before, which was Andy Burnham's disappointment at being rejected by the National Executive Committee to quit his post as mayor of Manchester and fight for the nearby seat of Gorton and Denton. Manchester, Paul.
Hi, Nick.
Paul.
I think that he's doing a major job in Manchester, so why should he not have the opportunity to help the country with his expertise? You know, with Starmer, the country's going in one way. If he can help the country, we've seen in Manchester what he can do, so more than happy for him to help the whole country with it.
Well, for those of us who don't live in Manchester, give us an idea of what you've been impressed with about Andy Burnham's mayoralty.
Crime is very good. Crime is very good down here. You don't really see communities being being scared to go shopping or to walk around other communities. The traffic is reasonable, okay, especially when you compare it to other big cities, and it's 10-star. The pavements are good. The buses are good. Buses are actually very good. Not as good as London, but London is much bigger, so you need more buses. The metro is good. There isn't much... the potholes in certain areas are bad. Other areas are very good. So there isn't many X's that you can give him. You give him more 10 out of 10 than 2 out of 10 in most things. In every place you'll find something maybe that's not the best. That even the police have been a bit better. The ambulance service, I think, has gone better. So it's most things is for sure upward trend, and he's doing a good job. So if Starmer is scared of him, and Starmer should look in the mirror, then obviously someone's doing a better job. So maybe he should get the Prime Minister job.
All right, good story to you, Paul. Thanks for that. 0345 6060 973. Kay Harding says, Andy Burnham is pro-universal basic income. He is trying to save and protect us, Nick. Well, you can be pro-universal basic income all you like, but I can't see it ever happening. Let's see now. I'll take a break, and then I'll come back with more of your calls. 0345 6060 973.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
A Home Office in crisis.
Latest figures show a near record-breaking number of migrants arrived in the UK in 2025.
A Home Secretary up for the fight.
Our asylum system is broken. The breaking of that asylum system is causing huge division. It is a moral mission for me to resolve that division.
She's got 99 problems, and the boats are one. But now a new plan to shake up British policing. The solution to the crime conundrum, or a bit of a cop-out. Find out next week as Home Secretary Shabana Mahmood takes your calls in another exclusive edition of Call the Cabinet on LBC.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Hear that? It's your big McDonald's hunger calling. Because the Big Arch is back. And this time, it's here to stay. With juicy beef, cheddar cheese, and that Big Arch sauce. Hungry? You are now. Order delivery on the McDonald's app. Serve from 11 a.m. Upcharges and fees apply to delivery orders. Subject to availability, price and participation may vary.
Hi Derek, Tara from Flash Designs here, hope you're well. Not sure if you've seen my emails from last month, but could you please pay my invoice? Thank you so much. Bye. Hi, it's Tara, Flash Designs. Did you get my last voicemail? I know you're busy, but please pay my invoice today, if possible. Hello, again. It's Tara, again. Politely nudging, again.
Still chasing unpaid invoices? Let Sage Copilot help do the chasing so you can get paid up to 7 days faster. Search Sage Accountant today.
Hannah entered the Omaze Million Pound House draw and won a £4 million house.
House, an actual house!
Paul won a house too.
That's insane.
Now you could be next when you enter by midnight tonight at omaze.co.uk. Because one person is guaranteed to win a £5 million house in London with all the furniture and a quarter of £1 million just to help you settle in. Roger recently opened the door to a brand new future.
Is this a dream?
And this time, it could be you.
And here's the best part. You'll be supporting Alzheimer's Society.
So for your chance to win a luxury house in London worth £5 million, you must enter by midnight tonight at omaze.co.uk. Over 18s only, no purchase necessary, conditions apply. £1 million charity donation.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
More of your thoughts about Andy Burnham and how his rejection by the NEC is reflecting on Keir Starmer and the Labour Party more generally. 0345 6060 973. But let's first take a call about the conversation that I was just having with the former Chief Superintendent. Adrian on the Isle of Wight. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I'm just a little bit confused because I'm a local councillor and we are told that with having devolved status, that the Police and Crime Commissions all would be scrapped and the existing money the existing pot of money will be transferred to the mayors. So I can't see how this new government scheme could benefit for new vehicles and new nothing, because it will be the regional mayors that will be in charge of the budget. And I'm just a bit confused.
Well, perhaps the one is not necessarily connected to the other. I mean, it makes sense to have a sort of a central purchasing system, if that is something that can save a lot of money for cars and uniforms and so on. But it might be separate to what the Home Secretary is going to announce on Monday, the new National Police Service, which is billed as our FBI, and this post of a National Public Order Commander. I mean, the two might not be connected.
But, yeah, I'm going to wait and see with envy to see what the announcement is. Because we are, you know, I've been told several times that we would get more money per region under devolution and scrapping the police and crime commissioners. And the money will be transferred to the local mayors, which, at the end of the day, the local mayors are in, will be in, will replace the police and crime commissioners.
Well,
and
perhaps,
therefore oversee the police.
Yes, well, perhaps all will be revealed on Monday, and we'll both find out at the same time. Adrian, thanks for that. 0345 6060 973. Wigan, hello, Margaret.
Oh, hello. Hello, Nick. I was just saying to you, your assistant, that I'm quite disappointed that Andy Vernon really has gone for this, as, because he's done so well as Mayor of Manchester, and he's only halfway through. I really think he should finish the job he's doing.
Yeah, it's a four-year
stint. Just leave it mid.
Yeah, it's a four-year stint, isn't it? And it's not quite 2 years in.
Yeah. And he's just like going to leave it. And I think he also, by doing what he's doing, he's sort of possibly putting a split in the Labour Party. And that's the last thing they need. I mean, we've just got a Labour Party after 15 years of Tories, and already they're fighting with one another. And, you know, it's ridiculous, isn't it?
I mean, I keep hearing how good he is as a mayor of Manchester. I don't have any personal experience of it. But if you are that good at a job, then isn't it a good idea to stay in that job that you are good at, rather than risk not being as good doing another one?
Yeah. I mean, we are really on the edge we come under Greater Manchester, but we're really on the edge in Wigan. In fact, we're as near to Liverpool as Manchester.
Hmm.
So it doesn't affect us that much. I suppose the city gets the advantage, really. But he was always popular when he was MP of the League, you know. So I just feel a bit disappointed that he's making this move against Starmer, in a way, who's got so much on his plate with all the foreign policies he's got to attend to. And I just think they should give him a chance.
All right, good talking to you, Margaret. Thanks for that. Nadia in Hastings says it is completely the correct decision. If Andy Burnham had ended up in Parliament, then it would have ended up in a naval gazing, and infighting. If the mayor's job had been lost to Reform, everything Burnham had achieved would have been dismantled. Reform would not be happy with the B buses, those cheap and free fares. The country needs the whole party to be fighting for the change in the country, not amongst themselves. It is exactly what turned the nation off the Tories. Close scrutiny of them for 14 years didn't help, but, you know, all that infighting, the changes, the expectation that whoever was in number 10 one day might not necessarily be the same person the next. Carnforth, hi, Annie.
Oh, hi, Nick. I think it's totally the wrong decision, actually, but I think it's very typical of the Labour Party. Somebody was just saying about, oh, you don't want division in the Labour Party. The Labour Party is riven with factionalism, and this is why Andy Burnham hasn't been allowed to stand. The NEC know that Starmer is a dead man walking, and he won't be the Prime Minister after May. There will be somebody else chosen, but it will be somebody that they want, because the NEC is very heavily controlled by Starmerites and Blairites and people who don't want somebody like Andy Burnham. Even though Andy Burnham isn't that left-wing, he's not anything like as left-wing as, say, Jeremy Corbyn.
Mm.
I'd call him more middle of the road, but he's still not really right-wing either. And it's so disheartening because I think he's the only chance that they have against reform. Andy Burnham is the only person that has that kind of appeal to a lot of people, whereas, you know, the Wes Streetings or Bridget Phillipson or any other person that, you know, they could come up with, and as Wes Streeting is definitely on manoeuvres anyway, he's just going to be seen like Starmer. He's got virtually no charisma. He's very right-wing. He's... You know, people want somebody that's inspiring. Like, Andy Burnham's quite an inspiring speaker. And he's done lots of good things. And he's got a track record of doing good things. In fact, when he was, I think it was in Brown's government, he was the health minister. He was the only person that I've ever heard talk any sense about social care. And he's been trying to put that kind of thing in, well, not exactly the same thing, because that sort of got trashed by the Tories. You know, the Tories really called it a death tax and all the rest of it. But yeah, he's been trying to integrate social care more with the NHS and doing lots of good things, which the country really needs, and that this Labour Party, you know, the Parliamentary Labour Party have just completely ditched social care, just kicked it down the road as if it doesn't matter. But it does matter, because it's having a huge impact on the NHS. So we need somebody like Andy Burnham, because he's full of good ideas. He's a really good speaker. And what really annoys me is that they would rather see Labour lose the next election than have somebody that is not from their side of the party. And this is what the Labour Party is like. It's terrible. And you can even see it with your party, because that's been a real disappointment. But it's because both Jeremy Corbyn and Zara Sultana are both from the Labour Party. And they just can't... there's a faction thing going on between those two. And I'm thinking, God, the Labour Party, just pull yourselves together and stop all this... You know, yes. He's not one of us, she's not one of
us. It's the left's thing to wrestle each other to the ground in a fight of purity, allowing the right-wing party to step over their writhing frames and take the tape.
It's also, though, the Tories do it too. I mean, they're both Labour and Tory, they're very factional. The only ones that seem to me that aren't that factional is the Green Party, because they're much more democratic. I mean, at their conference, it's the members that actually make the policy. They all vote on the policy, whereas if at the Labour Party conference, they can vote for things, pass motions and things, but the Prime Minister and the ministers don't have to take any notice of it, which is what happened at last year. I think, I've forgotten what it was they voted on. I think it might have been to stop allowing arms to go to Israel, or there was something that, yeah. And they just ignored it. The whole of the conference more or less voted for it, and it was like, oh well, you know, I'm the Prime Minister, so you know. Then it's not a very democratic party the way it's run, the Labour Party, and it's so factional. And I just feel, you know, this was their last chance. They will probably lose this next election now, because they'll just get some right wing non-entity. I can't think of anybody, you know, really charismatic out of that lot. And you do need... I know it's not all about charisma, but you do need somebody who can speak well and inspire people.
You need somebody who can sell what they're doing.
Yes. Yeah.
All right, good talking to you, Annie. Thanks for that. Bodmin. Hello, Malcolm.
Good evening, Nick.
Malcolm.
Nick, I love Annie like a sister. She knows that, right? But she could not be more wrong. Keir Starmer has had an amazing week, Nick. Now, let me explain why before you fall off your seat laughing, right? I foreshadowed, Nick, a week ago on one of your shows that Starmer had the potential to have some space and cover to not turn on Trump, but to stand up to Trump. Lo and behold, a week later, he did exactly that to some extent. And Nick, this man from Manchester, he knew that he had zero chance of getting onto this list. Let me tell you why.
Well, I wonder, but I mean, that's what I started the hour with. I wondered if that was actually true. Yeah.
The actual vote, Nick, was 8-1 against Andy Burnham being added to the list, right? 2-1. What Andy Burnham has to realise, and Annie bless her up in the north of England, what they've got to realise is, this is Starmer's party. It's what people like me and people who elect governments, in other words, people at the centre of politics want, Nick. We do not, I don't, look, for Annie, Corbyn has got his own party. The young lady he's partnered up with, the one he fights with every day of the week, they are there to be voted for, Annie. Vote for them. They will give you what you want. Honestly, Annie, they will.
They might promise it, but their ability to deliver it is to something else entirely. Malcolm, I'm going to have to leave it there because I've just run out of time. Nothing I can do about the hour. Sorry about that. But appreciate the call. And thanks for your text, by the way. I couldn't get through all of them. Sorry about that as well. Now, in the next hour, after the tragic killing of Renee Good only a few weeks ago, another American citizen has been killed by Trump's forces in Minneapolis. I'll be speaking to the vice president of the city council in Minneapolis on what it's like being in that city now.
Your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock, the government's announcing plans to get more police officers back onto the streets of England and Wales. It says it wants to move them away from back officers as part of a general overhaul of policing being announced tomorrow. LBC's Laura Makin-Isherwood has more.
The creation of a new force nicknamed Britain's FBI has already been announced, but more changes are on the way. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, will set out a raft of reforms that ministers say will help cut red tape and unnecessary admin and get police officers back out on patrol. New targets for 999 response times will also be set, with teams expected to get to crime scenes within 20 minutes of receiving a call.
It's believed the body of one of the two swimmers who went missing off the Devon coast on Christmas Day has been found. Emergency services were called to Exmouth Beach earlier today. The remains of a 47-year-old man who also went missing were discovered on Wednesday. Andy Burnham says he'll return to the job of running Greater Manchester with full focus after being blocked from trying to become an MP again. Labour's national executive has rejected his request to run in the Gorton and Denton by-election. Mr Burnham is seen by many as a potential Labour leader who could replace Sir Keir Starmer. The Labour MP and former Minister Barry Gardner has been talking to Nick Abbott on LBC.
We all want the Labour Party to do well. Everybody in the Labour Party should want us to win that by-election to stop the threat of any other party getting another seat in Parliament. But I do think that democracy in the party would have allowed the widest possible choice for the local constituency to make, and Andy should have been part of that.
The American Nurses Association says it's deeply disturbed and saddened by the killing of the registered nurse Alex Pretty in Minneapolis. The 37-year-old was shot by U.S. government immigration agents on Saturday. The country's Border Patrol Force says an investigation will uncover all the facts surrounding his death. And Gaza's health ministry has accused the Israeli forces of killing three Palestinians in the territory. It claims they died following two separate shootings. Israel's military says it's not aware of one and has offered no immediate comment on the other. LBC weather, mostly dry across England and Wales overnight. Light rain, which could turn wintry over higher ground for northeastern Scotland, and a low of around 2 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
ICU nurse Alex Pretty, 37 years old, shot dead on Saturday, marking the second killing of an anti-ICE protester in the city of Minneapolis in the space of a single month. Let's talk with Jamal Osman about that. Jamal is vice president of Minneapolis City Council and joins us on the line now. Hello, Jamal.
Hello. Hi, thanks for having me.
Appreciate your time. What's the situation in Minneapolis now?
Well, situation is very tense right now. People are still protesting The killing of our residents, of course, by the ICE, the video that everyone have saw, put Minneapolis in a crisis. You know, Rene Good should be alive. Alex Pretty should be alive today. But we have been dealing with this horror for the last few weeks.
Is it fair to say that all of this was predictable? And if it was predictable, then is it possible that it was actually planned? Not planned as this, as far as the specifics are concerned, but the idea was to flood an area, not necessarily Minneapolis, perhaps, but somewhere, and the with the intention of normalising the visible presence of unregulated, trigger-happy, untrained, militarised, masked goons designed to strike fear into the public.
Yes, it was very predictable. As a city council member, the mayor, Jacob Fry, have, and our chief of police, Brian O'Hara, has talked about it many times and said this will happen. They have not been communicating with our local law enforcement, our local leaders. They have been, you know, doing horrible things to our residents. You know, what they're doing is not normal. They are detaining U.S. citizens. They are stopping people because how they look or how they speak. You know, they even detain Native American residents. We're talking about, that doesn't make no sense. These are the people that, you know, their land has been stolen, but they have been detained. Four of them have been detained. And they're just anyone who does not look like white. They are stopping and detaining them. So we have called them out to work with us to stop having untrained, as they call it, peace officers, which they're not a peace officer, untrained folks to our city, and they're harassing people. They're, you know, they're killing people in the city in the daylight. So it's really sad day here. Everyone feels just sad. As a sad day, there's absolutely nothing we can do as a local government or the state other than lawsuits. Our governor spoke today on the media and mentioned that we will continue to sue them. Our attorney general, we're hoping the court can stop this invasion and stop this from the federal government killing its own citizens.
But the federal government doesn't appear to be interested in what the local courts say. I note that there was a two-year-old child that was picked up by these ICE forces. As far as I'm aware, the courts instructed those officers to release this two-year-old child, and instead they put him, they put the child on a plane with his father, fair enough, and flew them to Texas. So they don't appear to care what the law says.
Yes, of course, that has been the story for weeks now. They're not listening to the courts, but that is, we're hopeful. And I'm here to say that someone who lives a few blocks away, three blocks away where Renee was shot, and maybe four blocks away where Alex was shot, and my residents who are mostly immigrants and Native American community in my district have been dealing with this. The federal government is not interested. The vice president of the United States came to us in our city and hold a press conference and lie in front of us and lie what we're seeing. They have lied what happened yesterday, the video that we all saw. They have lied and they are telling us it's not real what we're looking at. And their story, it just doesn't make sense. And other than the lawsuits, I don't think there's any more option for Minneapolis to, for Minnesota, they have. And he, of course, also remember threat us to that he will send the military. So our president, the protesters have been very peaceful. They have been very peaceful. We haven't seen any buildings burned down. We haven't seen any riots. We haven't seen any of that. That is what he wants us to do, and we have not done that. There was about, maybe Friday, there was about tens of thousands of people came out in a negative 30 degrees Fahrenheit. And next day, someone was shot and killed. So we're just hopeful that this will go away.
It doesn't seem likely that it'll go away, though, does it? Because if it is indeed part of a plan, and that's what it looks like to my eyes, then the plan is going perfectly well. And you're instilling, well, the Trump administration is instilling fear into the public to make them frightened, not just to protest against the actions of these masked goons, but to even show up and film them while they're doing it. And it just seems as though the intention is to create this sort of a panic and fear and anger, and then to double down rather than to back off.
Yes, yes. I think we had enough in Minneapolis. You know, we're angry, we are grieving, we are frustrated. What's been happening? It doesn't look like it's going to stop. It looks like it's going to get worse for us. But, you know, what else can we do? What else can we do than just continue to peacefully protest and hope that something can take place? I am looking out for my, you know, looking up to my governor and my attorney general to do something. You know, they are doing what they can, but I don't know if there's any more we can do. And I'm hoping that the other states can look at this, and the Congress and the Senate and even Republican, that American citizens are being murdered by their own president. And that's just a sad day in America right now.
Yeah, Trump's excuse this time is that the man that they killed had a gun. Now, that might seem extraordinary to people in the country that I'm sitting in, but
sure.
Trump is the right to carry arms president, isn't he? It seems a bizarre thing for him to highlight as being indicative of criminal behavior, because that's what he's for, surely.
Yeah. Our chief has mentioned and have reported that Alex had a permit to carry. He has the right to carry and to exercise his rights. And as we saw the video, as you watch closely, the videos, many videos that have been looked at it, Alex never reached out his gun. His gun was on the back. And officer pulled out, not officer, I guess, agency, ICE agency, or ICE thugs, as the family call them, pull out the gun, and the other one started shooting him. So, they can't escape this. This is, the world have seen it. They cannot tell us what the reality we're looking at. It's not real.
But they are doing that, though, aren't they? It's almost like 1984 come to life. The quote that keeps coming up is, reject the evidence of your eyes and ears. It was their final, most essential command. And that's the position of the Trump regime, isn't it? You didn't see what you just saw.
That is exactly what has happened, and I'm hoping that his supporters, people on the other side of Republican, this is a blue state, this is a Democratic state, and I believe that's why he's targeting. This is one of the states that have the least immigrants. You know, in Texas, which is a Republican state, has the most so-called undocumented immigrants. He's not focusing on there because Republican-controlled state. So this is, of course, politics, but people's lives are on the line, and we're just grieving and really sad day here in Minneapolis. But we're going to continue to stand up and speak, and he made our town, our city unsafe. That's what I just leave it. It's unsafe here.
The thing that occurs to me is that, I mean, this action on behalf of the Trump regime is against those of, is against people of color. The intention is to target non-white population. And yet, the last two people that have died at the hands of these individuals are white. Do you think that that actually might get through to some of the Republicans who still, by a large margin, are supporting the actions of these enforcement agents?
If this doesn't get through them, I don't know what will. I mean, the folks was East African Somali immigrants before, which are 90 plus of them are U.S. citizens. And most of them have legal documents. Before, it was just a scapegoat. We were the scapegoat. But now the reality is that people, the American that are born here, the white Americans, are dying in the hands of his regime and his government. And I'm hoping that they will wake up. And I haven't really seen any of so-called leaders in the Capitol Republican Party leaders I haven't seen them spoke out against this. I feel like somehow he put himself in a loyal folk groups that are around him, and anybody who stands up, speak out against him, he's gonna fight with them or maybe end their career. That's what they're afraid of. We have seen that. So I don't know what will wake them up if this does not wake them up, because anytime, any minute, another person can die in the hands of ICE. Because we have 3,000 plus here that are just not listening and not listening to our law enforcement and not talking to anybody, but just treating people and shooting people on the streets in Minneapolis.
What about the role of the local police? Because I believe that they were prevented from sealing the crime scene when Rene Good was shot. And has the same thing happened with Alex Preti? Are essentially Trump's goon squad at war, essentially, with the local police force?
Yes, actually, yesterday, as soon as I hear that, I called the chief and I talked to chief's assistant. And one of the things, they told me that they were the first one to get there. When they got there to collect evidence to secure the crime scene, of course, FBI came, or the so-called federal agencies came and kicked them out. And then the state agency, which is usually does any involvement with any shooting involvement with the police, PCA, they came and they were also told to leave, and they will not share. This never happened before in the history of Minnesota. And the governor and attorney general today filed a lawsuit, or they will file tomorrow, where they will say, do not destroy the evidence, because we believe they will destroy the evidence of Alex murder and make sure that the justice will not be served for them. But we're hoping the court can stop them destroying the evidence.
And just finally, what's the reaction been like across America? Are protests taking place in other cities, in other states?
Yes, they have. I have seen them in cities like Boston, and you know, we were telling them and the other states that today is us, tomorrow you're next. You know, any state, it has to stop here in Minnesota. So people are realizing what's happening in Minneapolis. It could happen in their state. So they are actually picking up the phone, calling their congressmen or women and protesting on the street peacefully.
Very good to talk to you, Jamal. Thanks so much for your time. Jamal Osman, Vice President of Minneapolis City Council. Thank you, Jamal.
Thanks. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So what do you make of all that? I mean, good grief. It's just really quite astonishing what's happening in America, and it doesn't seem to be it doesn't seem to be doing anything but get worse by the day. 0345-6060-973. Take a short break. Back with your calls.
LBC. When you're
smiling. Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Every investor has a future in mind. Whether it's seeing your kids through uni. Or picturing yourself retiring in Tuscany. The hard part can be knowing how to get there. JP Morgan Personal Investing can help you see the path ahead. With our intuitive app, expert support, and 150 years of JP Morgan's investing experience, you can start making more informed investment decisions today. Search JP Morgan Personal Investing. Invest with clarity. Capital at risk.
There's one green bottle sat on my fridge shelf. This green and white bottle that supports my gut health. Beautiful by nature, biotiful by name. It's the tastiest way to up my gut health game.
Biotiful Gut Health. Upgrade your yogurt to the UK's number one kefir and reset your gut health with Biotiful. Kefir is a source of calcium which contributes to the normal function of digestive enzymes. For verification of UK's number one kefir, see biotifulguthealth.com/radio.
Something unexpected has arrived in Happy Meal. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Hello Kitty and friends are teaming up for the ultimate collab. Joining your little ones on a fun-fueled adventure. Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 2nd of February, from 11 a.m, includes one pre-selected book or toy, while stocks last.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Well, you've heard the phrase recollections differ, but people have a different opinion on the videos that they can see with their own eyes. The Minneapolis mayor, Jacob Frey, described the shooting as featuring six masked agents pummeling one of our constituents and shooting him to death. Brian O'Hara, the city's police chief, said Mr. Preddy had no criminal record and was a licensed gun holder. Lou Raguse, an investigative journalist at a TV station there, said you can see the agent in grey pull Preddy's gun from the back of his pants right in front of his border patrol agent, who draws his weapon. That agent then fires up to 10 times again after Preddy is disarmed. Well, that's the people that were there. President Trump released a statement. He said, this is the gunman's gun, loaded with two additional full magazines and ready to go. What is that all about? See, I thought he was the pro-gun president. He says, where are the local police? Why weren't they allowed to protect ICE officers? The mayor and the governor called them off. Right, so it's the Democrats' fault. He said, it is stated that many of these police were not allowed to do their job, that ICE had to protect themselves. Not an easy thing to do. Well, it's a pretty easy thing to do, to protect yourself from somebody who is unarmed, who has been pummeled to the floor, and you are able to shoot 10 times at. And the people that did it were so relaxed about it that they stuck around and counted how many holes they'd put in him. Atlanta, Georgia. Hello, Graham.
All very hyperbolic, I must say. One of the first things that you're taught in carry school, and I have a carry permit, is that you don't show up at events carrying. It's just not done. Very similar to the fact that...
Well, now, hang on a minute. What about the Second Amendment? People like you are all about the Second Amendment. You can carry a gun anywhere you like if you have a permit to do so. What's the problem?
Well, it's not considered proper to do that. Some people
That's
do
completely
it.
Incorrect. The National Rifle Association are up in arms about the district attorney for California, who has said pretty much what you just said. If the National Rifle Association is saying that, hang on a minute, don't say that you can't approach a officer of the law with a gun, otherwise you're going to get shot. I mean, pretty much is what you just said.
No, it's not.
Okay.
I said you shouldn't. It's poor form. Show up.
Okay. So the penalty for poor form is death.
And
you accuse me of being hyperbolic. Tavistock, hello, Rose.
Oh, hello, Nick. His gun was in his at the back of him in a holster.
Yeah.
And he was carrying a camera because what he was doing was not protesting but filming things.
Yeah.
And he was on the ground because he was helping two women who these oh so fearless ICE thugs had thrown to the ground. What has exercised me today is that just at this point of ICE's sort of highest achievement, if you might say, when it's become absolutely clear that there's a reign of terror by design over there,
yeah,
and that they're overturning the system of democracy and truth, our government and Priti Patel come out and talk about having a new FBI and a new ICE. And you think...
A new ICE? Well, I'm not sure that's...
Well, yes, because Priti Patel was interviewed today and was asked about this. You know, it's been mentioned before that the Tories would like an ICE. And she said, oh, yes, we need an ICE, but ours would be okay because they won't have guns. And this is dog whistle, Nick, in my view, because it's anybody with any other sort of sense would think... Well, you know, we'll avoid all this. But no, so who are they talking to? They're talking to the chunk of the country that basically lapped up the American regime's lies with relish, trumpeted a wish for a dictatorship, and will love these acronyms. Oh, yes, we're having our American things now. We're having our ICE and our FBI, hoping to see the US mirrored here. And frankly, we're all chasing reform voters, and it absolutely stinks. And I'm furious about it. Absolutely.
Yes.
I mean, not only that, sorry, but our government has also said their approach to democratic protests is riot squads. When did we last have a riot?
Well, the people that love all that stuff always think that none of the violence or the aggression or the privations are going to happen to them. And, the best of luck with that.
That doesn't excuse the people who are supposed to be leading our country and are supposed to be responsible people doing the best for it. That they're now waving like flags the terminology from the cruelest, most violent, fascistically deceitful, repressive state seen in the West for decades. We've heard it all. Everybody's heard it all. You know, and yet we're still imitating them. To chase the reform vote.
Yeah, I'm not sure that the FBI part is chasing what's in. I think they were just describing what this new separate force might be like.
Why pick those words? Why pick the American, you see?
Because it's what people understand. I mean, if the French probably have a force with an acronym, but we it's not very familiar to us. So I think that there's that. But I didn't hear what Priti Patel said, but who cares what Priti Patel says these days? Thanks a lot, Rose. 0345-6060-973. You know, with the greatest respect to Priti Patel and all. Who cares? Jordan in Leicester says, this sad event night, this is a sad event, and I don't condone what ICE have done, but the local police and mayor aren't helping the situation with the words that they are saying and inciting people to resist them. They likely wouldn't resist other enforcement officers. Not quite sure exactly what you mean. So it's the mayor of Minneapolis' fault. Right. And they're not inciting people to resist violently, certainly. They're underlining and putting it in bold that they should protest. If they do, then they should protest peacefully, which is exactly what that man was doing, and it's exactly what that woman was doing in the car, Renee Good, when she got shot in the face. I mean, it seems blindingly obvious to me, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, that, and I didn't have much time for that American guy, I have taken his call before, and he's always just picking the most right wing of any argument that you happen to be having at the time. It's kind of annoying. But it seems so planned to me, not necessarily for Minneapolis, but just for somewhere. Put these ICE goons, and they look very much to me like the kind of people that Trump blanket pardoned from the insurrection on January the 6th. They look like the wannabe military types. And I've been in places in America, and I've seen them come down from their compounds in their pickup trucks with their gun racks on the back, and you know, they've had people like this in America for a good long while. People who like to think that they're in a John Wayne film. And so there's and those people were blanket pardoned by Trump, and at the time I thought, well, Trump's done that in order to create his own private army, people who would be utterly, totally and completely loyal to him. And there was no justification for pardoning them, because many of them had committed other crimes before they tried to storm the Capitol and have committed other crimes since they were pardoned. You shouldn't be surprised about that. But it seems such an obvious plan. Flood somewhere in that's a democratic city with these ICE goons, give them, pre-excuse them for any crime they might commit, which they did. You can do anything and we will back you up. With pretty much Trump's words on the matter. And let these people who were too unstable to be accepted in the army, they were too unstable to be accepted by the police. So give them a mask and a uniform that has no identifying marks on it, and then let them loose with complete immunity. And what do you get? Exactly this. I think the only surprise is that the two dead people are white. But it seemed to be normalising the visible presence of an unregulated, trigger-happy, untrained, militarised, masked goon squad on the streets of America in order to instil fear into the minds of the American people that they cannot, will not, and should be terrified of acting in a way that's against the regime. Correct me if I'm wrong. And this is a precursor, I think, to putting those very same people outside polling stations come the midterm elections in November to dissuade people with great violence from coming and putting their tick in the box that might not please the president. 0345 6060 973. Jordan in... No, I've read that. Jason says, this is a genuine constitutional issue here. The reason the Second Amendment rights exist is because the author of that amendment argued that citizens needed arms so that they could form a militia to defend against overreach by a tyrannical federal leadership. That's exactly what it is. And those... The people have been yelling about their right to bear arms for that exact reason for all this time. And then when it comes to the point that they have a tyrannical leadership, then suddenly you should have left your gun at home. Right, got it. 0345 6060 973. More of your calls on this after this news break. But immediately afterwards, we're going to talk about artificial intelligence. It's... An extraordinary event has just occurred in a laboratory in California. They have created life for the first time. Is it too good to be true, or should we be very alarmed? It's 11:30 on LBC, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
The government's announcing plans to get more police officers back onto the streets of England and Wales. It says it wants to move them away from back offices as part of a general overhaul of policing being set out tomorrow. It's believed the body of one of the two swimmers who went missing off the Devon coast on Christmas Day has been found. Emergency services were called to Exmouth Beach earlier today. And Andy Burnham says he'll return to the job of running Greater Manchester with full focus after being blocked from trying to become an MP again. Labour's national executive has rejected his request to run in the Gorton and Denton by-election. LBC weather mostly dry across England and Wales overnight. Light rain, which could turn wintry over higher ground for northeastern Scotland, will see a low of around 2 degrees.
This is LBC.
You're really building that business, Josh. That's because you chose to bank with Virgin Money, earning cash back on your supplies. Turning expenses into rewards on everything from Sanders to skip hire. He came, he soared, he conquered. Open Virgin Money's M account for business now. UK excludes NI, Channel Islands and Isle of Man. 18 plus. Terms and exclusions apply. Cashback rate of 0.25% backed by the current account switch service. Virgin Money is a trading name of Clydesdale Bank PLC.
Hiya, Kenny the Hamster here, beloved pet of Doug and Carol Brookbank. Now, I've got to hand it to Doug and Kazza. They're doing school pickups, jobs, trips to the supermarket, and still find time to get healthy. Apparently, it's down to some NHS Healthy Choices quiz. Only took them 5 minutes to do, then gave them a simple plan to get started.
Come on, kids.
Total amazeballs.
Take your first little step to healthy. Search NHS Healthy Choices Quiz to get a score and a plan that's right for you.
Big motoring world are big on choice. But what does that mean for you? Well, we have thousands of cars in stock. So let's say you want a Mini, an electric one, in black, with a panoramic roof, Apple CarPlay, heated leather seats, rear view camera. Yep, there it is. Being big means we're more likely to have the right car for you. Big Motoring World, we're big on choice. See website for nearest store.
Leading Britain's conversation, Nick Abbott. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
For the first time in history, scientists have used artificial intelligence to design the genetic code of a brand new biological organism. It's in Stanford University, where they have a new virus attacking a colony of E. coli bacteria. And from that, big things may ensue. Let's talk about the prospect for all of that with Gina Neff. Gina Neff is Professor for Responsible AI at Queen Mary University. Good evening, Professor.
Good evening, Nick.
This sounds both a good thing and like Frankenstein technology. Should we be scared?
Well, let's start with the positives. We know that AI can lead scientists to really good ideas of things to test in the laboratory. And that's what's happened in this case. We've had a complex set of mathematical tools that help scientists match the elements of DNA with a little bit more precision. It's like a big matching game. And this tool called Sidewinder is letting them hook those elements up in ways that are likely to work. So there's really great possibilities that AI can help in discovery, can help with generating ideas. I don't think we want to jump to Frankenstein just yet.
But it all sounds like something that we have no knowledge over where it will go when it's released. I mean, will it save us from disease or kill us all? How can we know?
Well, I think that's one of the conversations that we have to have, and we have to be thinking about how we use these tools responsibly. So in this particular case, you know, we have scientists who are being given a recipe of sorts. And it's not just one recipe. It's essentially a cookbook for a whole new way of cooking. And what this is going to enable them to do is to test new ways of combining elements to do synthetic biology. Synthetic biology has been being done in the lab. So this kind of first time ever is a little bit of a stretch, but the idea that it's being done on genetic code is pretty new. We've had things where genetic code's been worked on. And of course, your listeners will have heard about disease interventions that are, gene therapy interventions. That's kind of tweaking parts of genetic code. But this is wholesale creating those. And what the AI part is doing is it's giving the kind of roadmap or cookbook for where you should look. And it's the scientists themselves that are looking. There's some really great ideas and pretty strong, bright lines for where we can do things that are good and where we shouldn't be tampering or playing with just yet. One of the great things in this country is scientists have been at the forefront of thinking through some of those ethical dilemmas. We've seen it in in vitro fertilization debates that happened in this country. We've seen it in questions around other genetic testing in the past. And so we have to match these AI innovations with the really great innovations around how people will be working on the regulation and governance of such technologies.
And am I right in thinking that mRNA, the vaccine for COVID, is really the first time that most of us will have experienced this sort of technology, or is it a different type of thing entirely?
Well, I'm not the biologist. mRNA was, in my understanding, a platform for allowing scientists to very quickly innovate so they could effectively have a base system or platform that they could create new kinds of combinations around to target specific kinds of drugs. And as we know, the vaccines made us safer, and they were able to allow us to restart our society in record time. But the interesting thing here is that we know tools like CRISPR, that's another household name. These kinds of tools are based on this combination of computation and biology. And the opportunities are incredible, but we do have questions that people are going to want to raise. I think the headline story on this particular one that the Times is stretching us a little too far into the fear-mongering aspect. Yes, it's a very simple piece of code compared to a virus, a very simple piece of code compared to a human genome. And, humans have been manipulating a gene, so to speak, since they've been breeding peas in pods. They've been working on trying to get those hybrids the way they want them. So, you know, that we're working with bits of code is new, that we're working to think about how we build better societies by shaping that world around us. That's not new at all.
Yes, it also seems to be the technology that could build a better us. Are we actually looking at the path towards the creation of a sort of a superhuman race?
Well, that's where we need to have those hard ethical questions. And I think what we do when we have these conversations like the one we're having tonight is we bring a lot of people into into that big circle of that conversation. So I think most people would be really uncomfortable with the idea that we breed better humans. That's an idea that comes with, really very frightening history. And it's not something that most people are comfortable with. So having the agreements that put in place what is illegal and what is ethical is absolutely right. In terms of having a virus that helps us control bacteria that, make many people ill and cause millions of deaths in humans, that's probably a system that most people would be willing to sign up for.
Yes, it's very difficult to know where is the line between good and perhaps evil, because if you had the choice, and presumably you shortly will have the choice of having offspring that have been cleared for genetic diseases, then where's the line between that and creating offspring that are going to be taller and more muscular and better looking?
Well, we're a far way from that. And we're far away from that from the results that were in this study. So the idea that this work will be used to tinker on the human genome, I think, is something that makes most people uncomfortable. Again, you know, at one time, the idea that we had, the meeting of an egg and the sperm in a petri dish made people feel uncomfortable. In vitro fertilization made people uncomfortable. And yet through really hard deliberation around the ethics, the bright lines exist until today. We have a system that lets families who would not otherwise be able to have families start families. So, you know, partly that bright line between good and evil is something that we figure out as a society. And that's the part I think that's going to be really interesting over the next few years when we talk about advances in responsible AI. We have to be talking about advances that work for benefit of people, and we have to be talking about how we're bringing more people into that conversation. And these bright headlines that we get, like today's news, are opportunities to have that conversation.
It's a bit different now, though, isn't it? Between the scientists who worked on in vitro fertilization and the people behind artificial intelligence, they're two completely different types of people. And the people who are behind artificial intelligence, the sort of handful of people who are essentially running the world now, they don't seem to be too burdened with ideas of morals and doing the right thing.
Well, I think we have to draw a line, like I do, between the people who are running tech companies and building social media platforms and the people who are working in labs. And you're absolutely right. We use the word AI to talk about both. What was being talked about in this paper that was just published in Nature has really very little to do with the so-called large language models and has a lot to do with using computers to match up pairs of numbers, essentially putting page numbers on genetic code so you can rematch those pairs again. And you know, I think you're right that those being driven by whatever motivations they're being driven to build out the large language models and increase the amount of AI being used in our everyday social media feeds and on our internet, you know, that's being driven by very different motivations than what's happening in the laboratories. And I would hope that we could get to a place where more people take that sense of responsibility and ethics from the laboratory and they hold on to it and they try to build out our media ecosystem in the same way. But that may just be hopeless optimism.
Are you concerned about the potential use of this technology with the military? Because surely if you can with laser-like focus concentrate on an individual's cancer cells, for instance, and provide a specific cure for that individual, then surely you can use that technology to wipe out many individuals of a certain type.
Well, you know, this may be a topic for another conversation, but we've had pretty strong international rules and norms around biological weapons. And, you know, I for one would like to live in the world of those rules. Now, that may be changing. There is still something that I think most people think the use of biological weapons is a step too far. Again, what today's study shows is that, you know, we're looking at something that is an order of magnitude, 1/20,000th of complexity in terms of the amount of code involved for a piece of virus code versus a piece of human code. Sure, there are evil things that can be done today. I think we have to continue to work to build out the kinds of systems that rein in people who think they can work without those systems, work outside of those rules.
Just taking AI more generally, the godfathers of AI, those people that have invented it and are pushing it forwards, they have admitted, they've warned humankind that we are going down a very dangerous path, that there's a, depending on who you talk to, a 25% risk of AI overtaking humans and deciding to wipe us out. And yet they're going hell for leather to try to beat each other to this pot of gold at the end of the rainbow.
Mm.
If the people that are making it are telling us that there's a quarter of a that there's, you know, a 25% chance that it's going to wipe out humankind, but they're doing it anyway, then there are no guardrails, are there? There's no reins on any of this.
Well, I beg to differ. The UK has built out the world's leading AI, national AI lab working on AI security. And that came out of the Bletchley Summit. And, you know, there's a lot of really smart minds working on the very small risks that the absolute worst can happen. I'm actually not in the camp that AI is going to get loose and go wild. I'm much more afraid of the billionaires. I think the billionaires empowered with the weapons of the state are much more dangerous than the potential of AI, some kind of AI apocalypse. I was, struck by the Nobel Prize speech for AI when the metaphor that was used was, imagine that all of humanity is sitting on an airplane. We're building the airplane and we're going to fly it and it will never stop. And we have to figure out how to repair it in flight. And that seems a little extreme, right? That assumes that we're building out these systems that we're never going to be able to take on offline, that these systems somehow will be so deeply ingrained into our society. And yet we see all kinds of things that keeps big tech in check. They certainly don't want to see the UK come into enforcement in the Online Safety Act. They're certainly afraid of deciding to turn off and shut down on social media accounts. There's certainly ways that we can opt out, and there's certainly ways that we can create better pathways for participation. And I think to say that AI is all powerful and is going to control us all is akin to just throwing our hands up and quitting. And I'm not a quitter.
Very good to talk to you, Nina. Thanks so much for your time. Gina Neff, Professor for Responsible AI at Queen Mary University. And the best of luck to us all. Now I'm going to take a short break and then back to your thoughts about what on earth is happening in America.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
A home office in crisis.
Latest figures show a near record-breaking number of migrants arrived in the UK in 2025.
A Home Secretary up for the fight.
Our asylum system is broken. The breaking of that asylum system is causing huge division. It is a moral mission for me to resolve that division.
She's got 99 problems and the boats are one. But now a new plan to shake up British policing, the solution to the crime conundrum, or a bit of a cop-out. Find out next week as Home Secretary Shabana Mahmood takes your calls in another exclusive edition of Call the Cabinet on LBC.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
So, you're geared up for this Making Tax Digital thing?
Sure. I just need some new mud boards, bag of cavity tyres and a couple of lintels.
Hey, MTD, mate. Digital taxes.
Mm-hmm. It's an extension down Station Road on the corner.
Dave, digital taxes, mate.
Yeah. Probably will need some 2x4s. I'm going to go take the van in for a new fan belt. Squeaky.
Hey, Making Tax Digital, Dave.
Avoiding MTD. Sage makes tax simpler for sole traders. Search Sage MTD to get your free software today.
The following is from TfL.
I got loads of flowers the other day. And messages from people I didn't even know. My mate spelled out my name in tea lights. And my mom hung my favourite footy shirt on the railings. Next to the lamppost, where I got killed. By a nice lady. Just someone who thought it was okay to go a few miles an hour over the limit.
Speeding injures or kills over 1,000 people in London every year. Slow down. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters.
At Lidl, get great deals on award-winning fruit and veg with Pick of the Week. Save up to 35% with cauliflower now just 99p each. And with Lidl Plus, get red grapefruit for only 29p. In store now. Lidl, more to value. Limited offer subject to availability. Selected stores, GB only. Prices correct on 20th of the 1st. 18 plus terms apply. See lidl.co.uk/LPTV.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
People ask me, what's my good place? Sunday lunch with the whole family. And knowing that because I'm over 55, I can withdraw from my pension pot with a few clicks on the Pension Bee website. Ollie, are you feeding the dog?
No.
At Pension Bee, we believe that when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. Go to pensionbee.com and be pension confident. When investing, your capital is at risk. Withdrawals available from the age of 55, 57 from 2028.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott.
Right, back to your thoughts about what is happening. Excuse me, what is happening in America. With them, Alex.
Oh, hi, Nick. I think with Trump and the US, they clearly do have a plan, because there's the whole Heritage Foundation Project 2025, and then there's the whole Insurrection Act, which Trump is seemingly desperate to enact regarding Minnesota and other Democrat states. But I think with the brutality we're seeing by ICE, I don't think that was supposed to happen this soon. And the reason I say that is because we are dealing with some incredibly insecure men. And I don't know if you remember, but when these people started going around the streets, snatching people off them and deporting them to who knows where, a lot of the response was to make fun of them. They were being mocked as the Gravy Seals, as Mill Team 6. You had people playing Darth Vader's theme at them as they were walking along the street.
Yeah.
So now, because these people are so insecure and because the regime is so insecure, they've now been given carte blanche to do whatever they want to these people, to the public.
Yes.
So we're seeing first Renee Nicole Goods getting shot and now Alex Pretty being shot. And it's all obviously just deployed to try and get the Insurrection Act deployed. Because I don't know if you've seen in the US in October, I think 2024, there was a study carried out, so basically an experiment, to see what would happen for the United States to go into civil war. And it was by Claire Finkelstein and her team, and she's a professor at Philadelphia University. And it basically involves a American president in bringing in a deeply unpopular federal force to enforce a policy. The state officials resist to the point of bringing in a National Guard to protect people and to join with state authorities. And in response, the president, the federal authorities, then deploy the troops. And that would then give you a civil war of sorts in a state with the potential for it to spread.
Yeah.
Now, that was in 2024. Basically a war game by a university.
Right.
We're now 2026.
Do you know what the conclusion was?
There's an article in The Guardian, which was written just a few days ago by the person who carried out that study. And it is in The Guardian by Claire Finkelstein.
Right.
And the conclusion, I think, was basically just how precarious the situation is in the United States if a president really is determined to go down this route.
Well, it might be. It's an interesting idea that it happened a bit too early, because the midterm elections are in November, and if the president is going to call a state of national emergency and bring the troops out, then that would be the ideal time to do it, because the elections don't look, you know, the polling for Trump isn't great at all. I think at this point in his presidency, he's the least appreciated president of all time. So he's looking at, losing at least one of the houses, and perhaps his complete power to do whatever he wants. So at that point, I would not be at all surprised if he did not call a state of emergency and cancel the elections, or at the very least, put these ICE goons, his own personal private army, outside polling stations in areas where he thinks he might lose, thereby, and, you know, giving them carte blanche to just slam people to the ground and shoot them if they feel like it, and thereby lessening the turnout.
Yeah, and I think you're right. And one thing I haven't seen mentioned is, particularly with regards to black and brown people especially, feeling as though they can't go outside for fear of getting all their children being snatched off the street.
Yeah.
It's incredibly similar to what was going on during the time of Jim Crow.
Yes,
where,
well,
of
I mean,
course, you'd have these people, look at the Ku Klux Klan, outside polling stations to deter black people from going in.
Yeah. It's like we're watching the History Channel in real life. Thanks for that, Alex. 0345-6060-973. Fraserburgh. Ricky. Ricky. Too late. Let's have Eileen. Birmingham.
Oh, hi, Nick.
Hi, Nick.
Yes. Very interesting what that last caller was saying. I think Trump's 36% or something in the polls at the moment, which is staggering in itself. But
yeah.
Yes, I mean, and I think that man might have a very good point there about it coming slightly early. No doubt in my mind that this is all geared up to the midterm election cancellation of. No doubt in my mind whatsoever. And I mean, before Trump was elected, when he was on the campaign trail, he stated categorically, you will never have to vote again.
Yes, that's right.
It's on video.
He just cannot stop saying the quiet part out loud. Yes, you just have to vote for me this one time, and then it will
you will never have to vote again.
Well, I think the thing he said was, then it will be fixed.
That's right, exactly that. And the cry of his people, if I can call them that, is that Trump always does what he says.
Well, sometimes he does what he says.
That's what they say. So they actually voted for against democracy. I mean, they knew. They don't want democracy. They want Trump in power forever.
Well, yeah, I'm looking at a poll of, the question, do you think the tactics used by ICE have gone too far, have not gone far enough, or have been about right? Democrats, 94% think that they've gone too far. Republicans, 80% think that they have either not gone far enough or have been about right. So, I mean, that's a country split right down the middle.
Yeah. The thing is, Nick, you know and I know, America have always had a race problem. And when, you know, when we had Obama for two terms, I'm writing that, aren't I?
Mm-hmm.
It just bubbled and bubbled and bubbled for these racists. And it was just unbearable for them. And this is, I honestly think this is partly a reaction to that. you know, they just have never come to terms with people of a different colour. You've got your Christian right. Not all Christians, I want to add.
No, you're talking about people. America. You're talking about people who claim that they're Christian, but act in every instance in the opposite
every
way that Jesus would do.
Absolute opposite. Yeah. And if you remember, Trump. Oh God, you know, it seems so long ago now. With his Bible, do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
It was vomit inducing.
Yes, it was. Yeah, that Bible didn't burst into flames in his hands is astonishing to me. Eileen, I've got to go, but thanks for that. Now we're going to change it up after the news. By the way, we will have Simon Marks, our excellent US correspondent, in the next hour. But immediately after the news, a new study has found that many people who work night shifts can go days without seeing daylight at all. What kind of impact does that have on our long-term health? Are you working a night shift right now? Do you do nights? And if so, how is it working out for you? 0345 6060 973. Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Nick Abbott, LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midnight. The Home Secretary is due to set out a package of changes to policing in England and Wales in Parliament later on today. Tonight, the government's announced they'll include a push towards getting more officers away from red tape and admin and onto the streets. On Saturday, the creation of a national policing service described as a British FBI was also announced, but the former Metropolitan Police Chief Superintendent, Dal Babu, has been telling Nick Abbott on LBC any changes won't happen overnight.
This will require consultation, working with local communities, working with staff associations, police federation, superintendents association, to make sure that the service doesn't disadvantage people. So, you know, all the concerns that people have, there'll be an opportunity to feed into it, be there for organisations to be consulted and make sure that people have genuine confidence in the new system that's been proposed.
A woman in her 60s has died after getting into difficulty in Belfast Lock. The city's Coast Guard says three people were taken to hospital after spending time at Helens Bay Beach on Saturday afternoon. The Border Patrol Force in the US says an investigation will uncover all the facts surrounding the killing of a US citizen in Minneapolis on Saturday. It's being claimed 37-year-old Alex Pretty assaulted immigration agents who then fired in self-defense, although video evidence has appeared to contradict that. The vice president of Minneapolis City Council, Jamal Osman, has been telling LBC it's hard to act against federal forces.
There's absolutely nothing we can do as a local government or the state, other than lawsuits. Our governor spoke today on the media and mentioned that we will continue to sue them. Our attorney general, we're hoping the court can stop this invasion and stop this from the federal government killing its own citizens.
The government's being asked not to forget the issue of growth in the UK economy as it focuses on tackling the cost of living. The Centre for Cities think tank says that's what will ultimately raise household incomes. And it's being claimed nearly half of UK consumers would trust AI to do their shopping. A technology platform says they would also be happy for it to pay for the items. LBC weather mostly dry across England and Wales overnight. Light rain, which could turn wintry over higher ground in northeastern Scotland, will see a low of around 2 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
New research suggests 2 in 5 night shift workers, including NHS staff and emergency service members, can go for 3 days or longer without seeing any daylight. Let's talk about this and the consequences of working at night with Dr. Neil Stanley, who is an independent sleep expert and joins us on the line now. Good evening, Dr. Stanley.
Good evening.
So what is the effect, then, of working the night shift?
Well, I mean, very, very simply, we evolved on this planet to be awake during the day and asleep at night. So the thing that tells us to be awake is sunlight, and the thing that tells us to be asleep is dark. And so working a night shift for however long and there's a multitude of different ways of working night shifts is going against evolution, essentially. And so there are profound consequences of working nights, and not having any daylight, as this research has shown, is meaning you're living completely against what nature intended. So, as I say, there are consequences to that, and this is why night shift is for many people a very difficult thing to do, to cope with. They probably leave doing night shift. Some people find it suits them from a lifestyle point of view, if they've got childcare issues or something like that. But it's not, working shifts basically is not good for you. There's no way of sugarcoating that fact.
Is it better if you are doing nights to keep on that schedule, or say you get 2 days, 3 days off of the weekend to flip back to doing days?
The problem with the flipping, if you are on permanent nights, life happens during the day. Your family, your children, etc., are probably active at the day. So you may work nights and you may get accustomed to working nights and it starts feeling okay. But then suddenly, at the weekend, on your days off, it's very easy to flip back to normal life in the daytime. And the thing is, we know that it takes about a day to a day and a half for each hour that you change. And this is work from jet lag. So say you flew back from New York to London, which is 6 hours, and it may take you 10 days to get back to normal. And the problem with shift work is that you're never going to have 10 days to recover and recuperate and then have the time to move on. So you're in a permanent state of disharmony with your natural rhythms, and that's the problem. So let's say there are, in America they favor permanent night shifts as the way to go, whereas in the UK we favor that sort of rapidly rotating shift. There are various different studies that shows that one or other is good for you, is better than they are. But as I say, there is no way that you could. I mean, the great classic book about shift work is called How to Make Shift Work Tolerable. That's as good as you're ever going to get, tolerable, which is not a good word. It's not a really positive word. And I say so. What is interesting is, in the past we worked shifts because of, mines and steel works and that sort of thing. It was impossible to switch off the machine. The human capital was exploited to work shifts. But we now, of course, don't have any of these things. And yet we still persist with shifts. And what we don't ever do is look at how to make the shift work better. We just, divide the day into three 8-hour periods and that's it. And we don't sort of consult the staff. We don't try to optimize how to do shifts, which would pay absolute dividends because, if you get shift work improved, you'll increase productivity, profitability, you reduce accidents and sick leave. But we don't seem to do that. We just think, we can work whenever, wherever, however. And that's just not true. The human cannot do it. And so, simply.
So what then are the consequences for people who do find themselves working night shift for their attention and their performance? Given that a lot of the jobs that are on nights are, for instance, in the NHS, life and death decisions.
Well, absolutely, and these are massively impaired because, as I say, you are never working the shift long enough to get habituated to that shift. So, yes, if I were to be having an operation, I would be wanting to have that at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, not 2 o'clock in the morning, without a doubt. The impairment of memory, of motor skills. Sleep deprived doctors make 48% more clinical errors. They take twice as long to interpret simple test results and things like this. So the biggest danger is you're driving home from a night shift when you are massively increased risk of having a car accident, much, much, much more than if you're over the drink driving limit. So they're those daily simple things. You have more rows with your partner, you have higher rates of divorce, things like that. And then there are the longer term health risks of increased heart disease, heart attacks, strokes, things like that. So, as I say, there's no good thing about working shift work. However, if you are going to work shift work, it should be made as good as possible. And that's where we fail. I say, you can't say, oh, no, we're going to do, in a utopian world, we're going to do without shift work. That's never going to happen. But we should be looking at what we can do. We used to allow doctors to have restrooms. So if they weren't if they weren't doing something over the night, they could catch some Zeds in a restroom. They've all been taken out of hospitals because now hospitals view that doctors are working shifts, and so they should be working. They shouldn't be able to be sleeping on the job, and that's massively increased the issue of medical mistakes and doctors not doing their job as well as they could do. So, as I say, we need to move away from this simplistic attitude of, as I say, anybody can do shifts at any time and they can do it in any pattern that we decide to do. It can be made better. And we need, as I say, we need as a grown-up society to think about that, because, as I say, we're not having people working in the foundry or down the mines. We're having people doing life and death decisions in the health service, the police, the fire service, these sorts of things, air traffic controllers. They need to be rested in order to do their job at an optimal function.
And in the winter, many of us don't really get out very much and see much sunlight at all. In the summer, of course, that's different for those of us who are working during the day. At night, is there a difference between the effects of night shift as far as winter and summer is concerned?
Well, actually, it is slightly perverse that winter is better because, as I say, the signal for being awake is sunlight. And so if you're working an overnight shift in the summer, you'll finish your shift and you'll drive home in daylight. And it only needs 4 or 5 minutes of daylight to tell your body, oh, it's time to be awake. And the body goes into daytime mode, and that means that when you get home, you're going to find it very, very difficult to sleep. Whereas in the winter, because of the darker mornings, you might be able to get home before dawn, before the sunrise, and therefore you actually might find it just that little bit easier to sleep. But what we know is that shift workers, compared to working days and sleeping at night, a shift worker will sleep 2.5 hours less by trying to sleep in the day. One, because they're going against what their body wants to do, but also because of the noises. Amazon haven't yet decided to deliver in the middle of the night. I'm sure they might consider it, but they haven't yet. So everything happens during the day. If you want to post a letter, if you want to go to the post office, et cetera, et cetera, you have to do that in the day, and we haven't got a 24-hour society, so it's difficult for a shift worker to get the sleep they need, and so they are sleep-deprived just because they're not getting enough sleep, let alone the consequences of actual shift work.
Yeah, and the consequences, perhaps, of seasonal affective disorder, which is it's separate, but it's related, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. Seasonal affective disorder is just a depression that is caused by having less sunlight. And, of course, if you are working shift and you're not even, you're not being active in the day because that's when you're trying to sleep, that will significantly increase. And, we know that, shift work increases risk of depression, anxiety, et cetera, and, you know, probably that is in people expressed as seasonal affective disorder. So, as I say, there are no good benefits of shift work to a person's health. They may have to be doing a vital function, but we do need to have an adult conversation about how we make shift work as good as it can be for those people who need to do it.
Are there anything that people can do to mitigate the effects of working nights? Like, do artificial sun lamps help, for instance?
Artificial sunlight can help. Also, knowing what suits you, because of course, if you think about it, if you work a day, you go home, you have your dinner, and then it's a long period of time before you actually go to sleep, you know, 3-4 hours or so. Whereas if you come off a shift, you eat your dinner or your breakfast or whatever, you know, whatever meal that happens to be, and then you go straight to bed. And that might not be the ideal. It might be better for you to sleep later, to stay awake a bit longer, even though you may be tired, and then get sleep later, or even have two periods of sleep. You have that initial going to bed and have 3 or 4 hours there, and then have another period of sleep just before you go to work. Because that's how, you know, a daytime working, you know, we get up at 7 and we're in at work at 9. So it's not just about going to bed immediately you finished your shift and then, you know, waking up at early afternoon and then, you know, waiting to go back on your shift. You can moderate if it works for you. The other thing is to make sure you eat healthily overnight. A lot of hospital canteens close at night, so the only access to food is a vending machine. So, you know, make sure you take healthy food with you. If you can, nap during your breaks during the night, but not nap too close to the time you go home, even though that might be the time that you're the sleepiest, because that will fool your body to think, oh, we're going to have sleep now. You know, I'm really exhausted. Oh, you're giving me sleep. Oh, no, you've woken me up again. So, you know, having a nap around midnight or so, 1 o'clock, if that helps you, fresh air, exercise, all of these can help. And as you mentioned, light bulbs, LED boxes or bulbs, and you can now get light bulbs that simulate daylight. These have been designed that again would make it easier for you to work that night shift because you're getting that positive signal of light, and that's what you say what is essentially what you're lacking overnight. So there are things that we can do, but I say it needs to move away from just this. I've worked a shift, I've driven home, I have, you know, a meal of some sort, and then I go to bed, then I wake up, and then I sort of fiddle my thumbs until I go back to, you know, doing my shift. It's not the way that works.
Very good to talk to you, Dr. Stanley. Thanks so much for your time. Dr. Neil Stanley, independent sleep expert. Well, what are your thoughts on this? If you're in the NHS, I'm kind of surprised to hear that doctors have had their beds removed. I mean, if you're on call in a hospital and you're there overnight, surely you should be able to sleep if there's no job for you to do. A lot of overnight work is driving, of course. Do you think that working nights affects your ability to drive well? And have you found any coping mechanisms work if you are a night worker? Do you have any tips that you could pass on to those who might be starting out on nights? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
This is LBC.
Train to Cambridge and then all aboard the paddleboards. A little bit different, should be fun. All wobbly, all wet.
The wetsuit's a good look on you, Steve.
Oh, actually, this is very relaxed.
George is up the river can without a paddle.
Train home, that was such a laugh. I think I might even have a new hobby.
Download the Thames Link Railway app to book tickets and save a third off group travel on off-peak journeys. Thames Link Railway, where every stop is a story.
It's not easy being a clamp, stuck on the wheel of the one person on the street who didn't tax their car. Yeah, Graham at number 7, I'm talking about you. Bet the neighbourhood group chat is as well. Wish I had a group chat. Maybe I can chat to myself. Hi, Clampy. How's it going? Not great, Clampy. Being clamped to the only untaxed car for miles is so lonely. Over 98% of drivers tax their vehicle on time. Tax it. Don't risk it. Visit gov.uk/DVLA/taxit.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
So this is a story that was on our own website, lbc.co.uk, and it's about new research that suggests that 2 in 5 night shift workers, including NHS staff and emergency service members, can go for 3 days or longer without seeing any daylight. Now, if that's you or you have experience of that, how was it? And do you have any coping mechanisms to put up with not seeing the sun at all, really, during the whole of your working week? Cobham. Hello, Anna.
Hello. Hi. How are you?
Good, thanks.
First of all, I'd like to say I don't come home and twiddle my thumbs like the doctor just said just now. I've worked nights for 20 years, and for me, it's routine. I think everybody is different. I don't think everyone is exactly the same. I mean, for example, he was talking about the life cycle of life. Owls are nocturnal. Tell it to the owls. They don't stay up all day to catch daylight, do they? You know, they come out at night. For me, personally, working nights, I work 9 to 5, but the opposite way around to everyone else.
Yeah.
I come home and I sleep when my children are at school. So the only time my children don't see me is when I'm sleeping when they're at school. And for me, that is a massive advantage. All my friends that work 9 to 5, they don't get to see their children for an hour in the evening. Because by the time they get home from work, they give them their dinner and they go to sleep. I've got much more of a connection with my family because they see far more of me because I'm able to work nights.
Right. I hadn't thought about that. That's interesting. So how did you get into working nights? Can I ask you what you do?
I'm a croupier.
A croupier, right. Casinos never close.
No,
no, they don't. So, and in a casino, there are no windows, are there? So, I guess does that help?
Not really. I mean, there's no windows, but we're still able to go outside on breaks, and you can see outside. But having said that, I sleep really when I sleep when I come home. So I sleep from 8 o'clock. A lot of people go to bed at 8 o'clock in the evening. I go to bed at 8 o'clock in the morning. And you know, I get up some sort of 3 o'clock in the afternoon. You know, so it's a case of, for me, I do still see the daylight. I do still see the daylight.
Do you have to use blackout blinds?
I've been doing it for so long, my body is accustomed to doing it. It's like I said, I feel like I'm a nocturnal person, and I always have been, to be fair. And it's what suits the individual. I'm not saying that everybody is cut out for it, but because we've been told that this is how it should be, doesn't necessarily mean that is how it is. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Everyone, you know, you're not born with a set of rules that says you must do this. I understand that your body reacts to daylight in different ways. So going back to what the doctor was saying, that when you see daylight, you wake up, and at night you go to sleep. But if you're not accustomed to that, it doesn't work like that. And I'm not accustomed to that.
So what happens on your days off? Do you flip to how everybody else lives their life?
No, I don't. I still do the same thing. I sleep during the day, and then I wake up in the evening. But, I mean, I tend to come in, I do my breakfast for my kids, and then I go to sleep. And that's kind of how it is.
Right.
You know, and then I get up in the afternoon, and I continue. And I've, but again, for me as an individual, because I do think it's down to the individual, it's something that I've always done. So I'm accustomed to doing it, you know.
And when you go on holiday, do you keep that up or do you...
See, holiday, there you've got a point, because then you suddenly have to click into the real world. But I mean, I don't go on holiday every week, you know. There's a summer holiday once or twice in a year. But then that's no different from someone going to holiday in America and having jet lag. It's no different, is it?
Right, it's no different. Okay, well, good talking to you, Anna. Thanks for that. Cardiff. Hello, Rennie.
Hi, Nick. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have so much respect for people who have to work the night shift, because I used to do that in America, and I did not like it.
What were you doing there?
I worked in healthcare.
Okay. And are you, from what you've seen of people in working nights in health hospitals, was it something like that?
Care home rehabilitation center.
Right. So, was there any part of you that thought, you know, at this time of night, I shouldn't really be making important, like vital decisions about people? I'm not at my best.
Yeah, definitely. That's why I have so much respect for healthcare and emergency workers. Yeah, I worked two different night shifts. I started out working the 11 to 7 shift, which I absolutely hated. Nothing worse than getting on a bus at 10 o'clock at night to go to work. Mm. And then as soon as I could, I switched to the 3 to 11 to 12 shift, which was still, you know, working part night, but it wasn't as bad as the 11 to 7 shift. You go home and you sleep and, you know, miss most of the day. It's not good. A lot of problems. It is not healthy. I developed, or you people will develop, really bad acid reflux because you come home and you eat dinner and then you go to sleep, which is not good, which I learned. That's really bad.
Right, lying down will bring the stomach acid back up, right.
Definitely. And it's not good to go right. I mean, even though you're really tired, it's not good to go right to sleep. You should try to, after a night shift, you should try and stay awake for some daylight. I think most people don't. I think most people are just so tired.
Yeah.
They go right to sleep, which is definitely not healthy.
Did you ever get used to it?
When I was working the 3 to 11 to 12 shift, I did get used to it. We used to have to work 2 weekends a month, and then we had, you know, not including the week, but we used to have 2 weekends off during the month and 2 on. Mm. So on the 2 weekends off, you had to do things during the day that you can really get to do any time else.
Right, so had to flip back to what as a daytime is called normality.
Yes, but it is very, very different from working during the day. Some people like it, some people love it. You know, they have their days free as much as you can, really. Mm. And some people love it. They get accustomed to it. They wouldn't want to work a day shift.
Yeah, there's a certain quietness, a certain sort of feeling that, a sort of feeling of uniqueness, as though you alone are alive when you're up at night and everybody else is sleeping. I mean, I don't have much experience of working all the way overnight, but I used to do sort of a 4-hour show that started at 1. I did that for a little bit, and also did a breakfast show, and that meant getting up at 4 in the morning. You know, when you had to get up for the 3 o'clock, was it easy to get up, or did every fiber of your being want to just stay where you were in bed?
No, like I said, I did not, the 11 to like the 3 to 11 to 12. I mean, it was supposed to be till 11, but I always wound up, you know, checking on people, and I usually didn't leave until closer to 12. But that was not that bad. But the, like I said, the overnight, the total overnight shift is just, it's too quiet, depending on what you're doing. And it wouldn't be bad if you have a lot of things to occupy you. But when you're on a shift like that and things are quieter, we weren't even allowed to sit and watch TV, even though we could see the patients, you know, call lights. We weren't even allowed to watch TV or anything like that to try and keep us awake. We just literally had to stay awake.
Painful. All right, well, thanks for that, Rani. Let's talk to a person who I believe is a GP in Wimbledon, Sarkunda.
Hi, it starts with F for Freddie, Sarkunda. Thank you. Hi, Nick. How are you?
Good, thanks.
This is a topic kind of relevant to me as well. I do listen to the LBC, and thank you for taking the call. Yeah, let me, like, this is the night shift that I have done. As a junior doctor or trainee doctor, you do two blocks of nights, three nights, four nights, depending on where you work.
Yes.
Yeah.
How was it for you?
It is difficult. It is busy.
It's busy, right. And did you feel that at that time of night that you were making reliable decisions?
We, as doctors, especially at night, is only a couple of them for the whole kind of on-calls. Or if you're in A&E, so it's two die kind of from junior doctors or trainee doctors, or they change now the name. So the resident doctors, they you get only one or two of you at night, depending how that hospital is established. And then you do make decisions, and you can't, if you're still a junior doctor, you can't run all the time to your senior, so you have to make those decisions.
Well, that's right. Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing, is if you have to make a decision, you don't really want to call up the consultant, because he or she is not going to be very happy to be woken up in the middle of the night, right?
Yeah, and same thing. If you're more junior than, like, senior health officer, SHO, as they call it, then in your early years, you have one senior doctor around you, so it's called registrar, and then you registrar is busy himself or herself, so
and doctors that were on call, they used to be able to sleep, didn't they? If it wasn't busy, and the doctor that I was talking to at the beginning of the hour, he said that those beds have been taken away. Is that right?
I think it was very, very long back. I have read a bit about it as well at the time. Junior doctors or resident doctors, they don't have no room. There is one general room for all the junior doctors in the hospital. It's called mess.
Yes.
It's got some sofas around, some chairs, some computers, and it just is shared between all the junior doctors or doctors to come and take a small break or have a coffee or tea. And even computers are there. For me personally, like your other listeners, everybody's in like different. Every individual works differently.
I guess so.
If there was, for example, a room that, even if you don't sleep, if you can just, you know,
just somewhere just to relax and close your eyes for 20 minutes. Yeah, that seems to make sense to me. I'm going to have to leave it there. But thanks for that. Right up against the news. In fact, I'm past the news. Now I'm going to take a call with our US correspondent before the end of the hour, but immediately after the news, we're going to be looking at why a recent survey found teachers are going above and beyond to support their homeless students. And as I said, we're going to get our update with Simon Marks before the end of the hour. It's just past 12:30, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
The Home Secretary is due to set out a package of changes to policing in England and Wales in Parliament later on today. Tonight, the government announced they will include a push towards getting more officers onto the streets. A woman in her 60s has died after getting into difficulty in Belfast Lock. The city's Coast Guard says three people were taken to hospital on Saturday afternoon. And the government's being asked not to forget the issue of growth in the UK economy as it focuses on the cost of living. The Centre for Cities think tank says that's what would ultimately raise household incomes. LBC weather mostly dry across England and Wales overnight, but there could be rain which may turn wintry over high ground in northeastern Scotland. There'll be a low of around 2 degrees.
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
They have fatal incompetence.
Straight to the point.
What is the problem they've got over there?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
The country's going backwards. Growth down, energy prices up.
Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
When it comes to retirement advice, the last thing you want is to be put in a bucket. Seen as this type of person or that type of person. At Fisher Investments UK, we never put you in a bucket. We always tailor retirement advice that's just right for you. Fisher Investments UK. Retirement advice that's as individual as you are. Learn more at fisherinvestments.co.uk. Investing involves the risk of loss. Fisher Investments UK is regulated by the UK Financial Conduct Authority.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
It's not easy being a clamp stuck on the wheel of the one person on the street who didn't tax their car. Yeah, Graham at number 7, I'm talking about you. Bet the neighbourhood group chat is as well. Wish I had a group chat. Maybe I can chat to myself. Hi, Clampy. How's it going? Not great, Clampy. Being clamped to the only untaxed car for miles is so lonely. Over 98% of drivers tax their vehicle on time. Tax it. Don't risk it. Visit gov.uk/DVLA/taxit.
I've been asked by Shredded Wheat to read out their ingredients list. Drum roll. Whole grain wheat. No, that's it. A single ingredient, high fibre cereal. Shredded Wheat. It simply does it. I'm telling you, that's it. Applies to Shredded Wheat bite size and Big Biscuit only.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
A survey has been conducted by the housing charity Shelter and NASUT, the teachers' union, asking 11,000 teachers about their experiences of working with children living in temporary accommodation. Let's talk about this with Mari McCrae. Mari is Director of Communications Policy and Campaigns at Shelter. Good evening, Mari.
Good evening.
So what did this survey find?
Well, there are now actually over 175,000 children who are homeless and living in temporary accommodation in England. And every single day, Shelter's frontline services are witnessing the devastating impact this is having on children. So we wanted to hear a little bit more about the impact it's having on education and the impact it's having on teachers. So we did this work with Teachers Union, NASUWT, and it shows that teachers are seeing exactly the same thing that we're seeing in our frontline services. You know, really exhausted children who are traveling for hours and hours to get to school from their temporary accommodation. They're really struggling to concentrate in class, really dreading another night in a cramped room with absolutely no space to study. And actually over three quarters of the teachers that we surveyed have said to us that it's leading to poor performance in exams. And that's really no wonder to us, really, knowing the sorts of conditions that children are being forced to live in, you know, very small cramped rooms, no space to study. We're hearing from teachers that they're having to refer children regularly to food banks. They're often having to, you know, support children with washing their uniforms and their clothes to come to school. There's really no conditions for children to have to be, you know, to be learning in and to be thriving in. And that's why it's really important that we take the housing emergency really seriously, because it's having such an impact on children now and for the future. But we do know that there is a solution to this problem. Luckily, we do know that what is needed to end the housing emergency is really ramping up the delivery of truly affordable social homes. That means that children won't be forced to live in temporary accommodation anymore.
I find it surprising that children have to travel hours to go to their school. Why can't the school be provided nearer to where they're living?
That's right. Well, this absolute shortage of truly affordable accommodation, this shortage of social rent homes, mean that families are being placed sometimes for hours and hours outside of the area that they're used to living in. You know, for many families, their children are settled. They've got this community, you know, in the school. They've got their friends, their family, a support network in their area. And when they're placed, in the nearest temporary accommodation, which sometimes can be hours, you know, far away from where they're used to, they don't want to uproot their children, and put them into a different school. And so we're seeing families who are making that commute, who are traveling 2 hours one way, 2 hours back, just to get their kids to and from school. You know, not only that, we're seeing, you know, when kids children are moved into temporary accommodation, they're often, you know, missing many days of school as well, you know, as they're being forced to relocate many times.
When you say temporary accommodation, give us an idea of what that actually looks like.
Well, you know, many of the cases that we're seeing at shelter, the conditions are really, truly horrific, I would say. You know, very, very small, cramped bedrooms with a whole family sharing one room, children often having to share that space, having to share beds. So they're coming into school not only tired because they're traveling far distances, but, you know, they're in one room with their family, they're sharing beds, they're not having a good night's sleep. They have absolutely no place to study, to do their homework, to think, to have a bit of peace, to reflect on their day. You know, teachers, we heard, having to help support with laundry and you know, washing children's school uniforms. That's because there's often not anywhere to wash clothes. There's no laundry facilities. There's often no place to cook a hot meal. You know, maybe even a microwave just in one room. So really, really, grotty conditions, as well as the fact that it's damp, it's cold. Often we're speaking to families where children can see their own breath in the air during winter time because it's so cold and damp in their accommodation, which is having, you know, a real impact on children's health. And often, you know, we're hearing stories of children living in these conditions with rodents and other infestations. So that's just to give you a little bit of a picture of some of the sorts of conditions that we're seeing record numbers of children in England living in at the moment.
Well, it's the kind of picture that Dickens used to write about.
Absolutely. We at Shelter think it's absolutely shameful that we should have 175,000 children in England alone living in temporary accommodation, no safe place to call home, and living in conditions such as this. And we know that it's having an impact on their education now, and it will continue to have an impact on them, you know, in the medium term as well. So we're not just talking about challenges and problems that we're seeing right now. We're talking about, you know, the next generation here, and, you know, the ways that we are failing to give them the support that they need to thrive.
That number, sorry to interrupt, but that number, 175,000, I mean, that sounds like a massive number. Is that a number that is falling, or is it going up?
No, it's, unfortunately, that number is rising. It's rising every year, and this is a direct result of decades of political failure to really focus on the housing emergency and to put the solutions in place that we know would solve the housing emergency. And that is the investment and delivery of truly affordable social homes. So we know that once we start to see the delivery of social homes, we won't have to see families placed in, you know, really insecure and grotty temporary accommodation. And families can put down roots, build communities, and, you know, children will have space to study, learn, thrive, and be part of their community.
And does the Renters' Rights Bill actually touch any of this?
Well, the Renters' Rights Bill focuses on private rents, and that should increase security when it comes into force this May. So we're really pleased to have seen the Renters' Rights Act become law, and we do think it will make a difference. We're really looking forward to seeing how it's implemented in May, and we'll be doing everything we can to make sure that it provides the security for the millions of renters in England that it promises.
I mean, the way you described how some of these children and their parents are living is really quite shocking. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about levelling up. And these are presumably the poorest and least advantaged among us. And what you're describing seems to be a recipe to actually bake in and, in fact, make worse that wealth inequality.
It absolutely is baking in wealth inequality. And unfortunately and sadly now we're seeing that, you know, the scale and the extent of the housing emergency and the lack of truly affordable homes means that the housing emergency is touching so many people's lives. We at Shelter, you know, hear so many stories of people where really unfortunate things have happened, you know, people have lost their jobs or people have separated from their families. And it really doesn't take that much to, you know, push people into a situation where they're really struggling and they're finding themselves and their children homeless. And the situation with temporary accommodation means that it is absolutely baking in, you know, further inequality. I think often people don't recognize that people actually have to pay to live in temporary accommodation, right? So people are paying to live in the sorts of conditions that I've described, really poor conditions. It's baking in inequality because, for example, they don't have space to store food or an oven or a fridge or somewhere to cook. And so are having to pay, you know, through the odds or over the odds to be able to eat every day. They don't have a washing machine. So, you know, being forced to spend money on, you know, expensive laundrettes, things like that really add up. And it means that people aren't able to get back on their feet. You know, they're spending more and more money to live in really, really poor conditions and really struggling to find a way out of that.
Do you feel that sometimes when you're explaining this, that the people that are hearing it sort of other these people that you're talking about and convince themselves that that could never happen to them, but it actually can? All it takes is, as you've alluded to, is one or two missed paychecks and they'll be in that situation as well. But people don't like to think of themselves as, you know, with that possibility in their future.
Well, unfortunately, at Shelter, we found that, you know, people are closer to homelessness than they are to home ownership at this point. And I think that any conversation you have, you know, I think you'll see that people are really touched by the housing emergency in different ways, whether that's, you know, something about affordability or, you know, rental affordability or conditions or, you know, being able to stay in an area that's close to your family and community. There's many examples of ways that we see that the housing system is absolutely broken. And that's why it's really important that stories like this are covered, because it shows the impact of the housing emergency and it shows the impact that it's having on people's lives. So the numbers are huge and really shocking. But for us at Shelter, you know, meeting people every day, what's even more shocking is what people are forced to endure and the impact that that's having on people's lives now and for the future.
It is extraordinary, isn't it, that we're constantly told that we're the sixth richest country in the world, but it often doesn't feel that way. We talked about building homes. That's the long-term solution. What can be done in the short term?
Well, building homes is a long-term solution, but we know from decades of failure to do so that things need to start now and things need to be happening now. And we have been starting to see some progress from this government in terms of delivering against that. So we very much hope that it won't be too long-term a solution and that we'll start to see the benefits. You know, we need to be putting things into place now and building the foundations to start seeing the benefits of new, truly affordable homes sooner rather than later. And in the meantime, organisations like Shelter are doing our best to provide that, you know, emergency support to families and children that we're seeing every day.
Very good to talk to you, Mari. Thanks so much for your time. Mari McRae, Director of Communications, Policy and Campaigns at Shelter. Now, we're going to take a short break, after which, back off to America, this time to talk to LBC's US correspondent, Simon Marks.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Richard Spur.
French Rail's now offering child-free carriages so people can travel in peace. But would you welcome them here? And does Labour's restraining of Andy Burnham from standing for Parliament show signs of Starmer's fear for his own job?
Richard Spur at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
Go on, leave the never-ending laundry pile, quiet flat, and empty fridge at home. Hop on the train and go into the workplace zone with Southeastern. Whether you're heading in for a change of scene, to share ideas, or enjoy a lunchtime chat with your colleagues, with our great range of tickets, we've got the one to suit your commute. Buy yours now on our app or website and pay no booking fees. So, go on, go in.
Southeastern.
I'm Leah, and this is my NHS story. I could just feel my body didn't feel right, and my GP referred me to CDC. Had some blood tests done, and within 24 hours I had my results. And that just reassured me that I was being taken seriously.
The government is opening new community diagnostic centres, with many already available 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, so the NHS can be there for all of us when we need it. Find your closest one at gov.uk/NHS Fit for the Future. Available England-wide.
You know that guy I've been seeing?
Yeah.
Turns out my sister's been seeing him too.
Oh, really?
And I heard he's been seeing Kelly at number 56. And Dave.
Your brother?
Yep.
Specsavers opticians and audiologists own and run their stores, so your care is their business, which can make them rather popular.
I've got something to tell you. I've got half an hour with him this afternoon.
Specsavers. Your care is our business. Book an appointment today.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
LBC's Washington correspondent is Simon Marks, and he joins us on the line now. Hello, Simon.
Evening, Nick.
Donald Trump first addressed the killing of the nurse as by saying that the man that they killed had a gun, which seems odd from the right to carry arms president. I believe he's been speaking to the Wall Street Journal and has changed his tone somewhat.
He definitely has changed his tone. This has just come in within the last few minutes. The president has spoken on the telephone for around 5 minutes with Wall Street Journal reporters on Sunday. I think it is worth putting into context the fact that the Wall Street Journal is a Rupert Murdoch-owned newspaper, and it joined the New York Times earlier today in accusing the White House and the president's top officials of lying about what took place on Saturday in Minneapolis when 37-year-old Alex Pretty was gunned down by those Border Patrol agents. The president's own deputy White House chief of staff, Stephen Miller, has described Mr. Pretty as a would-be assassin. There is, of course, absolutely not a scintilla of evidence to back up that claim. Well, tonight in this conversation with the Wall Street Journal, President Trump is sounding a much more moderate tone. He has told the newspaper that the White House is now reviewing everything that took place in Minneapolis on Saturday and will come out with a determination. He has said, "I don't like any shooting. I don't like it." But he's also then gone on to criticize Mr. Pretty. He says, "I don't like it when somebody goes into a protest," and he's got a very powerful, fully loaded gun with two magazines loaded up with bullets. Also, the president saying that doesn't play good either. But he does not in any way accuse Mr. Pretty, as the Secretary of Homeland Security, Kristi Noem, falsely accused the 37-year-old intensive care unit nurse of doing on Saturday. He doesn't accuse him at all of attempting to attack or kill Border Patrol agents in Minneapolis. In fact, he expresses concern that the gun that Mr. Pretty was carrying, and remember, he was legally carrying that gun, it was a permitted weapon, and he was entirely within his rights under the Second Amendment of the Constitution to have it on his person, even under the very febrile atmosphere that was developing in Minneapolis. The president has said that he was concerned that it was a dangerous and unpredictable gun. It's a gun that goes off when people don't know it. Well, that's very different than what his other senior officials have been saying, claiming that Mr. Pretty was brandishing the weapon, another entirely false claim made by a whole host of mendacious senior Trump cabinet members and others, including the zealous head of the Border Patrol, Mr. Greg Bovino. Also, President Trump has told the Wall Street Journal, at some point, we will leave. He signaled a willingness to withdraw immigration enforcement officials from Minneapolis eventually. He said they've done a phenomenal job. He wouldn't offer a time frame for when he might withdraw those federal agents. But he said that his intention is to pull them out eventually. And then he plans to leave what he described as a different group of people there to address claims of financial fraud in Minnesota that the administration claims have been carried out, particularly by Somali groups applying for locally furnished government grants by the state of Minnesota to which they were not entitled. So I think this is potentially the beginning of the climb down by the White House. And it comes at the end, Nick, of a day where the president has been on the receiving end of criticism from many unusual quarters, including Republican lawmakers. Governor Phil Scott, a Republican of Vermont, put a statement out tonight saying, enough, it's not acceptable for American citizens to be killed by federal agents for exercising their God-given and constitutional rights to protest their government. He said, at best, these federal immigration operations are a complete failure of coordination of acceptable public safety and law enforcement practices, training, and leadership. At worst, Governor Scott said, it's a deliberate federal intimidation and incitement of American citizens that is resulting in the murder of Americans. That's the Republican governor of Vermont, Phil Scott, saying enough is enough. And remember that the president was also on the receiving end of what looked like carefully worded criticism from the National Rifle Association earlier today, the pro-gun powerful lobby group, which was basically saying there needs to be a full investigation of what took place on Saturday in Minneapolis before legal gun owners are villainized by powerful voices within the president's administration.
Yes.
So it looks to me like this is the beginning of a climb down.
Well, the National Rifle Association was freaking out because Bill Assayley, which is one of Trump's appointees, the temporary California U.S. attorney, said, if you approach law enforcement with a gun, there's a high likelihood they will be legally justified in shooting you, which is the absolute opposite of what the National Rifle Association believes to their bone. And so we're talking about the Second Amendment here.
Yes.
And so they had a major cow. And do you think that that actually might inform Trump's climb down more than a sudden onset of morals?
Yeah, I think without question. I think this that he was placed in an incredibly invidious position by the revelation that Mr. Pretty had this gun, was completely legally entitled to have it. And, you know, you can't have it both ways. Either you support the Second Amendment, as the president claims to do. You know, all of his top officials covet the right to bear arms that is guaranteed guaranteed by that Second Amendment to the American Constitution. So if you back it, you put yourself in a very difficult position when you turn around and say that anybody carrying a gun to a protest, even if they are doing so completely legally, should basically consider it justified if they find themselves on the receiving end of shooting by the Border Patrol and by ICE. But I think also the other thing that has stuck so badly in the craw of Americans all over the country, including many of Donald Trump's supporters, is this attempt to villainize Mr. Preti when the video and multiple videos gathered at the scene of that killing completely contradict the claims that people like Kristi Noem and Greg Bovino, the head of the Border Patrol, have been making. And you can't look at those videos and then hear what they say and reach any conclusion other than the fact that they have been brazenly lying in a bid to blacken the name of this 37-year-old American citizen, the second American citizen to have been killed and had their names dragged through the mud. Because remember, they did exactly the same with Renee Good 18 days ago, with the Vice President of the United States, J.D. Vance, saying that her killing at the hands of an ICE agent, a trigger-happy killer ICE agent, was justified. Again, the video in that case made that there wasn't any way you could look at that video. I know there are some Trump supporters that do, but no reasonable person could look at that video and reach the conclusion that she deserved to be shot.
And, you know, I hate to point this out, but they were two white people. Do you think that the climb down had anything to do with that? Because if they were black people, then I very much doubt that Donald Trump would have gone to the Wall Street Journal. But maybe I'm wrong about that.
Well, I mean, we don't know because of the circumstances. I think it's reasonable to surmise that that might be the case. I mean, also one wonders, you know, if they weren't American citizens, if they were foreign tourists on the streets of these cities, you know, would we be seeing the same kind of apparent climb down tonight? I think in this case, it's the gun ownership that has made the difference, along with the brazen nature of the lies that his top officials have been telling.
Yes, and there was a poll conducted by the New York Times, and admittedly it was before Alex Preti's death, but after the first death of
Renee Good,
yes. And the question was, do you think the tactics used by Immigration and Customs Enforcement have either gone too far, not gone far enough, or have been about right? Democrats, 94% of Democrats said that they have gone too far. 80% of Republicans said they had not gone far enough or were about right. So
yes, although some of this polling cuts a slightly different way, because Politico asked Trump voters in 2024 about their view of the tactics that the president has been adopting, again, before the shooting of Mr. Preti. And one Trump voter in three in 2024 said they approved of the administration's mass deportation goals, but did not approve of the implementation that's been underway. Now, that still means that two out of three were backing him, but there was definite movement there that I think also demonstrated that he was beginning to lose some ground, even among his fervent supporters.
Yeah. Good to talk to you, Simon. As always, thanks so much for that. Simon Marks, LBC's Washington correspondent. Now, if you missed any of today's show, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app on which you can read and watch the latest from LBC. You can put your news categories in the order you want. You can pause and rewind live radio and listen to a boatload of podcasts, in amongst which you'll find mine. If you don't have it, then the LBC app is free, as is the Global Player app from your app store now. Coming up at four, it's James Hansen. But first, Clyde Ball.
Good morning, it's Richard Spur.
I'm sorry, Richard, I'm just reading off the screen.
It's easily done. Nick, good morning, and good morning to you. The rail operator SNCF in France introduced a premium carriage on its high-speed trains that doesn't allow children under 12 on board. They say that the carriage offers a quiet journey that's ideal for working or relaxing, but critics argue it is simply not just to exclude children from public transport. What do you think? Would you like to see it here? And Andy Burnham said he's disappointed after Labour's governing governing body blocked him from standing as an MP. Former Shadow Chancellor John McDonald warned the Prime Minister, "If you think it'll strengthen you, I tell you, it will simply hasten your demise. You could have shown magnanimous leadership, but instead it's cowardice." So this morning, is he right?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom... Reforms to the policing of England and Wales, thought to be the most comprehensive for 200 years, are due to be set out by the Home Secretary later on. Shabana Mahmood's statement to the Commons will include the creation of a so-called British FBI and proposals to reduce the number of forces. They're also believed to involve a push to get more officers away from desks and onto patrol. LBC's Laura Makin-Isherwood has more.
The creation of a new force nicknamed Britain's FBI has already been announced, but more changes are on the way. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, will set out a raft of reforms that ministers say will help cut red tape and unnecessary admin and get police officers back out on patrol. New targets for 999 response times will also be set, with teams expected to get to crime scenes within 20 minutes of receiving a call.
The governor of Minnesota has accused the Trump administration of gaslighting American citizens over the fatal shooting of a man in Minneapolis. 37-year-old Alex Pretty was shot several times by immigration agents on Saturday. His family is disputing their claims he was armed and wanted to massacre law enforcement. The most senior ICE official in Minneapolis, Marco Charles, says his team has been getting results.
Since the beginning of this operation, we've arrested over 3,000